Recordings are rolling. Suzanne, at your leisure, KY6B.
Good evening, everyone. This is South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This TNT Open Forum is conducted under the guidelines of the South Cars organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and Good Amateur Practice. This SCAR server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by KB8ZGL, and all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. This TNT net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur-related subjects and or areas of general interest to those participating. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of our guest speaker or speakers. Information regarding our HF operation may be found at www.southcars.com and for our digital operation at www.voip.southcars.com. Your moderator for the session is N1SUZ. That's me. My name is Suzanne, and I am located in Danbury, Connecticut. I want to welcome Joe Garcia tonight. We have a special guest, and that's Joe, NJ1Q, the station manager for W1AW, the ARRL's very own flagship station. Joe will be talking about all things W1AW tonight, its history, facts about the station, and how W1AW is active in the community and in the heart of amateur radio. He will be fielding your questions tonight, too, so don't be shy. If you're curious about something to do with W1AW, fire away. Joe is ready to answer your questions. We will be taking breaks for the questions during Joe's presentation tonight, at which time you can just come aboard with your name and suffix, and at which time the net will recognize the stations and Joe will take the questions in order of who came aboard first. I want to thank Joe for joining us tonight and making some time for South Cars members in what I know must be a very busy schedule for him. Before we start tonight's presentation, though, Joe, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know I'm curious about how you became a station manager for W1AW, but also how you got involved in amateur radio. Joe, come on aboard.
Well, good evening, Suzanne, and good evening, everyone else. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this honor, actually, to talk about W1AW. And I greatly appreciate the invitation. And I just hope I do a very good job tonight. Hi on there. Well, let's see. I've actually been working at the league for 27 years now. It'll be 27 years in 3 days, right out of college. I'd gone to college to be essentially a bench technician. I took electronics technology. I had always been an AMSWL, even when I was a little kid, and so my love for radio actually started there. My parents used to buy me these little rinky-dink AM kits, you know, these little $2 things, and it was at a time when AM was really cool to listen to, and from there it kind of progressed to large radios and further distance stations and so on, until 1977 when my dad decided he wanted to get the ham radio, and said, well, we can do this together, and we did, and sure enough, I got licensed as a novice in 1979, got the general in 1980, and then my extra in 1983, and I decided to change the call in 1987. I started working at the league in 1984, September, and actually was right out of college. I needed a job real bad because, unfortunately, there were not a lot of electronic technician jobs available in the state at the time, and it just kind of progressed from there. I was working in QSL service, and then I was the manager, worked in DEC, worked in DXEC, did awards, and then the manager of QSL, and then in 96, the position of station manager opened up. And my boss at the time, Chuck Hutchinson, K. Charlie Hotel, old radio guy, was an engineer, HCJB, and so on. He knew about my abilities and how I was essentially watching the station for a few months beforehand. He decided, you know what, Joe, you'd be a perfect for this job. And he gave it to me, and pretty much the rest is history. It's been a real fun job. You meet a ton of different people. As I was telling Gordon last night, you meet hams from all walks of life, from all over the world, and you develop this perspective about the hobby and how a lot of hams perceive it, simply because you meet so many different folks. And it may sound corny, but I'm proud to be the station manager, because I've had this love for the hobby for so long and a love for radio that it just seems kind of natural. So I'll turn it back over to you, Suzanne.
Well, thanks very much, Joe, for sharing that. And that is you really have a varied background with the ARRL and W1AW. And I guess that's true with a lot of jobs. You start at the lower jobs and you work your way around. But I guess that's a benefit, though, because you really know all the different kinds of jobs. And maybe you can tell us a little bit before we go into the history of W1AW. What exactly is your job? I know you let people in and set us up at the studios, because that's how I met you. But what other things are you responsible for, Joe?
Well, I often joke that I'm the station manager, chief cook, and bottle washer. Pretty much everything with respect to the station, short of the physical plant, is what I'm responsible for. And even then, I take responsibility for that stuff as well. And it doesn't matter whether it's the antennas or the equipment, the broadcast equipment, the visitor operating stations, the painting, fixing of doors, clearing up the outside, and so on. Granted, there are some things that I'm not allowed to do, system when it comes to, say, air conditioning or something like that, because we're not certified. There is a certain amount of liability, and that sort of thing falls to our building manager, who is also a ham, by the way. But pretty much if it concerns the station, again, everything, the physical plant, whatever, I'm responsible for it.
Well, thanks, Joe, for letting us know that. And let me open up to the floor for a bit, and maybe somebody has a question about your job and what you do there. Anybody have any questions for Joe so far? All right, I didn't hear anything, so let's go on. Well, thanks for giving us a bit of your history, Joe. Now let's talk about the history of the ARRL and W1AW. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Suzanne. Well, as most of you know, the ARRL started in Hartford, Connecticut, back in 1914. And in a few years, we're actually going to be celebrating our 100 years anniversary, which we're actually all looking forward to. And there's not a lot being said about it right now, but we are quietly in the planning stages for some form of major celebration, which will take place in 2014. To my knowledge, it's probably going to last most of the year. Started in Hartford, and essentially it began with Hiram Percy Maxim, our founder, needing a part for a radio. And he found, because he lived in Hartford, he found that there was a place up in Massachusetts that had that part. So he needed to get a message up to that company, and he sent a message to a fellow, and I hate to use the word ham, but for this I will say, a fellow ham, and who relayed the message onto that company. And obviously a lot of things happened. Hiram had seen how amateur, or how radio at that time, again, they really didn't call it amateur radio. There was something to this. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of organization to it. I mean, there were clubs, there were radio clubs, there was radio in other parts of the world and so on. And so he, along with Clarence Tuska, gotta make sure I get that name right, decided we should form an organization to start getting these radio experimenters together. And so essentially, you could say the league was born then. At that time, he began to get individuals, also like-minded individuals, together. And I believe it was in 1915 when they came out with the first issue of QST, which is a very simple magazine. It was more of an introduction. They realized they needed this to be a membership service, and they decided, okay, why don't we start asking these like-minded individuals if they would wish to participate in this and give money to start this growing of this organization. And it continued on from there. Now, W1AW, his call sign was actually 1AW, and one MK at the time. There was another call that was used as part of Mars and so on, or Army radio at that time. And they decided, okay, well, why don't we have a radio station that we can use to transmit bulletins, stuff that would be of interest to hams. And again, it wasn't like what we have today, where we have propagation and FCC news and DX, and certainly not Keplerians and so on, but it was news that would be of interest to hams. And so they decided to do this using the facilities of a radio station. And at the time, when it wasn't being handled out of Hiram's house, he decided to build a building. I see I have a timeout here, so I'm going to just quickly kick it off for a second. Okay, I hope it didn't time out. But anyway, they decided, okay, why don't we have this radio station? And again, when they weren't handling it with Spark at his house, they decided, okay, why don't we have this building and we can now do this? Because if you ever seen some of the older pictures of QST, there is a shot of Hiram's house with this massive curtain antenna. And he had the Spark app generator, old Betsy, inside his home, and they would send out simple transmissions to folks. After that, it started to grow as the membership grew and as the organization became more and more organized. Hiram just saw that there is definitely something to this. And so they started to increase the capabilities of the station. And you got to keep in mind, we're talking the 20s and 30s here, where everything was still Spark app up until about 1928 and so on, where CW wasn't in the form that it was today. And certainly receivers were not as sensitive as they were today. So he had to run these curtain antennas and power and what have you. And, well, based upon the technology, he was able to get only so far. And that's where we had some of the relay stations come in, too, because, again, he felt, I can send out this stuff. We can send it to relay stations. There can be bulletin stations which get the information from us. Again, not in the same format as we have it today, but this started to grow. Now, the system or the actual station itself really took off in the 20s and in the 30s. Where we now have the official 1AW, 1MK station, which is in its own building, located on Brainerd Road in Hartford, which is about 5 miles north of Arrow headquarters now. We had the great flood of 1936. The flood occurred in March of 36. The flood essentially started in Canada, worked its way down the Connecticut River, and that took out the station. Now, interesting enough, Hiram Percy Maxson had passed away in February of 1936. He had never seen the devastation, and the feeling is that had he seen it, because he did love the station so much, that it probably would have killed him, because he did put a lot of time and effort into it. Granted, Hiram was an experimenter. He worked with Colt Armament. He worked with Pope Automobile in Hartford. He was instrumental in creating the cinema arts of Connecticut. He was doing all these things. He comes from a wide family of inventors and so on. But anyway, amateur radio, at least we would like to say, was one of his major passions. And therefore, he had passed away. The station was destroyed. Well, the League at that time had decided, we need to keep this going. It is in memory of him. Rather than try to rebuild that radio station, because it was so close to the Connecticut River and its tributaries, they decided to look around for a plot of land. Now, 1936 Connecticut, aside from some of the major factories like Colt and what have you, there isn't really a lot here. And the League at the time had found the property in Newington, Connecticut, which on some old maps, Newington doesn't even appear. It's that such a small town. They had purchased 7.25 acres from the Starr family, and in the front, right along Main Street, is where they began the construction of the radio station, that little brick building which I would pretty much say every ham knows about. That station was built and it was completed in 1938, and it was inaugurated on September 2nd in 1938, which happens to be Hiram's birthday, or September 2nd. And the inauguration was carried by a number of radio stations at the time, most notably here in Connecticut to WDRC, and I think one of the other New York stations as well. Now, because Hiram had long since died, the ARL had petitioned the FCC at the time to hold his call in memorial. And that is why we are still W1AW today, and why the call sign is emblazoned on the building, is because we had asked the FCC to do that, to hold in a memorial in honor of our founder, Tom, the old man, the guy that we call Grandpa in these pictures we have in the building. And to this day, it is still an honor to talk about Hiram. I mean, yes, he was like everybody else. He was human like everybody else. He had his foibles and so on. But considering the type of individual he was and the vision that he had for the hobby, it is something to be said. Now, I would like to say on that note that he was a staunch supporter of SparkGap, and he ran SparkGap till the very end, up until 1928. And the only reason he had to switch over to continuous wave or a clean CW was because his equipment was broken. And I guess he just wasn't in any mood to fix it. So I can say he begrudgingly said, okay, fine, I'll drop Gap, SparkGap, and go over to something else. Back to you, sir.
Well, it sure does prove that a passion for your hobby can really, really turn into something else. And that's what we have to owe Hiram Percy Maxim. It sounds like his passion really took off and really developed the hobby into what it is today. Let me ask you a question before I open to the floor, though. The FCC at that time wasn't really as integrated into the ARRL and call signs. Is that correct, or did they have a really big hand in amateur radio at that time?
I would have to say it's not like the organization that it is today. I mean, I'm pretty sure the federal government saw the writing on the wall. You had many experimenters at the time. You had DeForest and Armstrong, Tesla, Marconi, or at least for his early stuff. It occurs to me that the federal government saw that this was going to be a budding industry, for lack of a better term. And while I wouldn't say they were directly involved, they had gotten into some form of licensing, if you will, and call sign allocation. And so I would say yes, they did have some hand in it, obviously not like it is today. I mean, that has certainly morphed and grown over time as the number of radio enthusiasts has grown as well.
Well, thank you, Joe. This is N1SUZ, and let me open up to the floor. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to ask Joe about what we talked about or anything else that comes to mind? Please call now with your suffix and name, please.
Six, Victor. Gordon.
Gordon, go right ahead, Six, Victor. Joe is open to your question.
Hey, Susie. Thanks for running the show tonight. Good evening, Skipper. I'm going to call you Skipper Joe for two reasons, Joe. One, for your commanding W1AW, and then also the boat that you're going to put in the water tomorrow. It's interesting, you know. Let me make one quick comment. Joe, the timer on this server is 4 minutes, so feel free, but come up short on four, and you're doing a great job on that business. You know, the TNT that we run here on South Cars happens every Thursday evening at this hour, and we have a myriad of subjects, and we're just so pleased to have you with us tonight. On occasion, we have a trivia night, and it wasn't too long ago that one of the trivia questions that was posed on the program was, where did Hiram Maxim actually die, and when? to sort of bring into the subject that you're promoting here this evening. And we found that he had passed away in, I think it was Colorado. I hope I'm correct on that. At any rate, it wasn't back home where he should have been. He was on a train ride coming back from the western side of the United States, got quite ill, was put off the train, put in the hospital, and didn't move any further. But just a couple of quick questions, Joe, if you'd care to field them. I'd be very interested in knowing how many employees you now have at ARRL, and I'm talking the main headquarters, not necessarily all your section managers scattered across the countryside. How many people actually work at the main site? How many of those might be managers, department heads, and so on? I know that you probably have a lot of clerks and office personnel and so on. And I would also be interested to know, if you happen to have this figure handy, what is your total membership at this point in time? ARRL membership, and do you consider that worldwide, Joe? Back to you, KY6V, over.
Good evening, Gordon. Thank you very much for the moniker. Just a quick note to everybody listening. I was on here last night, and Gordon and I were conversing back and forth, and I had mentioned to him this morning in email that he had used a couple of nautical terms, and being an individual who not only loves the ocean but has been in boating for a while, I thought it quite interesting. So in an email, I said, gee, you must be a person of nautical. And sure enough, he responded back as being a ragbagger and a stink floater. And for those of you, those are sailboat people and I guess motorboat people. And I would be considered a stink floater because that's what I have. Nothing big, really small, but we pulled it out of the water last week because of Hurricane Irene. And I get to put it back in the water tomorrow because I refuse to give up on summer. But anyway, great questions. And yes, Hiram had died en route going, he died in Colorado. He was coming back from the West Coast, and he had something as innocuous as a throat infection. And he had died there. And he was, and he died, well, it was actually in February 17 of 36, because again, the flood occurred in March. It was February of 36 he had died, and he's now buried with the family in Maryland. As for the number of employees, we have, I believe, 102 full-time employees. We do have a number of part-timers that came in, I think about four. We have some volunteers, and those are our tour guides. The tour guides are volunteers. And the tour guides are near and dear to my heart because there was a time that I was the tour guide trainer, so I got to know the workings of every single department in that organization because I had to train these people, and they needed to know. For department heads, we have 10 because we have departments such as we have our production and our graphics, our technical department. Our MVP, which 1AW is a part of, which is Membership Volunteer Programs, or VEC, or Circulation, Controllers Department. We have Dave Sumner, K1ZZ, who is not only the trustee of W1AW, but also our Executive Vice President. So I say there's about 10. And as far as members, the last report I had seen is we were just under 160,000 members, and that is worldwide. And we would certainly like it to be a lot higher. And our circulation department, I do give them credit. They do try to get the membership. There's just a lot of hands out there that just don't feel they need to be members. And quite frankly, you don't need to be a league member to be a ham. Most of us licensed staff are league members, and we don't get a break on it. We pay just like everybody else. Because if nothing else, we understand the importance of the organization.
Very good. Well, I'll tell you what, South Cars has got a ways to go to catch up with you. But we've only been in business for 40 years, so watch out. Okay, Joe, over.
I'm sure the circulation department would love the competition.
All right, I've got a couple more questions, but I'm going to let everybody else get in here, and I'll pick them up as time permits. Susie, back to you. Thank you very much, KY6V, over.
Well, thank you very much, Gordon, for asking your questions, and thank you very much, Joe, for fielding those questions. And let me open it up to the floor and see if anyone else has any questions about what we've been talking about. And as you can see, Joe is more than willing to answer all sorts of questions about ARRL or W1AW. So please come aboard now with your questions, and please give us your suffix.
Sierra United, November.
Okay, NCS recognizes SUN, Kathy. And we also had the Russian station, I think, tried to come in. So, Kathy, you go ahead first. Joe, this is Kathy, K6SUN.
Well, good evening, Joe. So happy to hear you this evening. I heard you last evening as I was heading to bed talking to Gordon. It was very enjoyable. My name is Kathy. I live in Vero Beach, Florida, southern Florida. I'm a school teacher here in Florida, but I'm also the database manager, which is now assistant net manager. I guess it's all been incorporated into one, but I do a lot of emails out to people, stations that have connected that do not have emails on QRZ, and so I normally send it to ARRL.net. I never get them back, and so what I'm curious about is the stations that don't have emails and that I send these emails to, and is there a reason they never come back to me in case those stations don't have an email address? Maybe you could answer that for me. I do have something I'll ask a little further in the program, but maybe you could answer that for me, Joe. And thanks so much for being here.
Well, good evening, Kathy. Nice to make the acquaintance. And, normally the ARRL.net addresses are used by the members. Now, that being said, they would have to activate that in their membership settings. It's not an automatic thing. They had thought of making it automatic, but then the thought of all these people complaining about having their email being rerouted for whatever reason, they decided quickly, and by that I mean the folks who decided this in our circulation department, they decided to make it where they have to check it off if they want to have the ARRL.net alias. Now, that being said, they would also have to have a main email address. And I believe that within the membership settings, whether it be if you called up to become a member or you actually went into your own membership settings through the web page, if you do not provide a regular email address, like a Yahoo or Gmail or something like that, the ARRL.net checkbox would be grayed out because there would be no sense giving you an ARRL.net address if you don't have a primary email address. And that's what I'm gathering that might be happening. If they did not have it at all, if it wasn't checked off at all, obviously your email would bounce as undeliverable. But clearly, if you're not getting them back, it does tell me that they are getting them. The other issue, and we've seen this with a couple of providers in the past, is that some providers would actually look at stuff coming from ARRL.net as spam. And in fact, we would often list that on our webpage as something we're trying to work out with that ISP, the internet provider, to say that, okay, stuff from ARRL.net going to this individual is not spam, please let it through. But that's what I'm guessing is why they're probably not responding back to you. I would think out of courtesy, they would have to respond back to you. The policy at the League for email is you have to try to answer it within 3 days. Now, some staff get bombarded with email, so it's almost impossible for them to answer in 3 days. Other staff, not so much. So it would the expectation is that you must be able to get a response back within 3 days, and it's a courtesy. If we get these individuals that tend to not want an answer, just want a rant, then we have to kind of balance it out. But going back to the original thought is you would think this is a courtesy. If these individuals were getting the email, they would at least respond back to you.
All right, Joe, one comment is, if I don't get anything back from these stations, I'm assuming they receive it then, if it doesn't bounce back to me, because a lot of the stations don't have any emails there, and because they connect to SCARS, it's just a welcome I send out to each of those stations, and I send them to the ARRL.net in case they don't have an email. So I assume you're saying if they don't come back to me, they have received them. And if I don't get a response, it's just because they're not responding. You can answer that for me. But Suzanne, I see that Gordon also has a comment in the text box. Maybe this is about email. So maybe, Joe, you can let me know that. Just wanted to know if people are getting these emails that I send out, because none of them are ever coming back to me. Over to you, Joe.
Okay. Yes, again, the ARRL.net is purely an alias that we have set up for ARRL members. It doesn't necessarily take the place of their email address, only in that it makes it a little easier. Just for example, you probably remember the time when there was CompuServe addresses and Prodigy addresses. I know I'm dating myself, but at that time when you probably had 20 or 30 different letters and number combinations at CompuServe.com or Prodigy.net or whatever like that. Well, we decided that as a service, we can take these individuals who might have semi-long email addresses and say, okay, through our system, if you put your call sign at ARRL.net with your real or true email address as the actual email address, we can route it through. So if someone sends something to ARRL.net, as us being the provider, it would get routed through us. So they would have to have an email address, a regular email address first, and then, assuming they're members, ARRL members, they would have to have checked off within their settings or let our circulation department know that they want it. They would have to acknowledge or let us know that they do want to use their call sign at ARRL.net. So what might be happening is maybe that some of these folks are either not ARRL members, so they're not obviously not making use of the ARRL.net address, or they're league members, but they may not have an email address, which in today's day and age, I was like, who doesn't have an email address? I got three that I have to tend to. But that's what it sounds like what may be happening.
All right. Thank you so much, Joe. I think that helped me a lot, and I do agree. I have quite a few as well. So I'll turn it back to you, Suzanne. Like I said, I think KY6V has a comment he'd like to make. And thanks for allowing me to enter this evening's discussion. And once again, I have another comment towards maybe the end. Suzanne, I'd like to ask Joe. Very interesting tonight. So back to you, N1SUZ.
Well, thanks very much, Kathy. And Joe, Kathy is our assistant net manager, and she's responsible for keeping all of the emails and all of us in order. So thanks, Kathy, and thank you for asking the question, and thanks, Joe, for covering that for her. And yes, I saw Gordon had a comment. KY6V, come on aboard.
Yeah, thanks, Suze. Hey, you know, that's very good information, Joe. It's answering a bunch of questions that I've had for a long time. Before I ask just a couple of short questions, Joe, are you in charge of the computer section? Does that fall under W1AW, or is that in circulation, or what?
The computer section, the actual entire system, is actually handled by our IT department. They're responsible for the mainframe, for all database records, circulation records, DEC records, DXCC, so on and so forth. In terms of the station itself, they will pretty much give me bare bones computers, and I get to set them up in any way I need to, providing, of course, that I have certain systems installed that our IT department use. For example, they require that McAfee be installed on every machine. They require that certain drives be mapped to, and so on. Now, you probably saw in my signature text that I do act as an administrator for a couple of lists that the league supports, specifically DXAC, CAC and VUAC, the internal lists are handled by these various committees. And that I do is purely administration. I will add individuals, remove individuals if someone's not getting email. These are internal closed reflectors, by the way. Then it's my responsibility to just kind of go in there and find out what may be the issue. But on a whole, the general computer system, and that even includes the purchase of machines, that is all handled by our IT department.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Joe. Understand. KY6V here. I have run into some problems in the past, although it seems to have cured itself. We put out periodic mass mailings to our SouthCars members, and I mentioned the numbers to you last night. They're rather substantial. And everybody that had an ARRL.net got bounced. Now, this was a while back. This is not happening now. Do you have a spam filter on that baby? Over.
To my knowledge, yes. The folks in our IT department, and I don't mean this in a bad way, are very retentive when it comes to spam and access to our system from the outside. So they do have in place various filters, like most companies do, to keep down that possibility of spam. And the reason for this is because when we first introduced this whole system of ARRL.net addresses, we had that problem. Phishing systems and so on would actually find these ARRL.net addresses and would pretty much just blanket like a quarter of the membership who were using these ARRL.net addresses with garbage. So therefore, they had decided, okay, we need to put further controls on this system to keep that from happening. Obviously, that has certainly worked itself out over the years because the system's been in place for a few years. So that's not so much a problem anymore. I'm not sure what may have happened, why everything else had bounced. Now, as you guys know, we have gone through a major web page upgrade. That did entail changing servers, changing the internal ISP providers that we use for that, and it meant changing pretty much everything, up to including membership data. There was a point in time when, as a list administrator, I had access to membership data. So if somebody called and said they weren't getting the W1AW bulletin, for example, I can actually check into it. With this new system, that was removed from me, not because they don't trust me, but just that they decided to take that away from a lot of staff who are not directly involved with membership and with our circulation department. So it's possible that if there was a massive bounce, it could have been during that interim time when they were changing over the servers, they were changing over the web pages, and as a lot of folks know, it was a real bumpy ride for the first couple of months when the system came on. But overall, I think aside from the spam filters that are on there now, they've got the system down pretty well pat.
Yeah, I haven't had any problems, Joe, for some period of time now. I'm very pleased about that, obviously. You know, we had SouthCars in the header. The start of the text was a graphics display of SouthCars VOIP, and everything goes along with it. And it hit that spam filter up there, and I could just see it going into orbit. But we're not having that problem right now. I need to ask you something else. I understand about blacklists. I've been fighting that for quite a while too. In our publications, so you don't have to go into any detail there. But I find it very interesting that you're a bouncing network, if I can call it a bouncing network, and that is you have to have a home email address through your server or whoever you may be using. You know, it could be Gmail or Yahoo or your local ISP. In order to enroll with the ARRL.net service. Now, I want to throw some statistics out here and see what you think about what I'm about to say. Having dealt with mass mailing for our membership for a long time, I have found, and I find this just absolutely staggering, that it is about close to, we use QRZ as our database for email addresses, for the lack of something that's better, and QRZ does a nice job, but a lot of people move, they get new ISP service, they never change their original email that they posted on QRZ, and it bounces, and it bounces, and it bounces. And I have found statistically that it is close to 40% of everything that is listed on QRZ is faulty in some manner when it comes to an email address. Are you guys fighting the same thing? Over.
In some respects, yes. And I wanted to just make a quick comment on something you said earlier. I'm not sure why they had decided to have a regular standard email where AOL.net is just an alias. It may be that they didn't want to necessarily get in. I don't want to speak, so it's just an assumption. They never really detailed it. And maybe they did not want to get into the email business to that level. So they said they would provide an AOL.net address as opposed to my email is njwinkthrough.aol.net, but that's regardless. We do have that problem. Now, what our system does, and I can say this with certainty because I see it with the lists that I administer, if an email bounces, and as you know, you can kind of tell why it bounces, mailbox full, no such domain, something like that. If it bounces three consecutive times, that email address is now put into a hold, as it were. If email continues to bounce, and I think it's another three or six, then the system is geared to say, okay, we're now going to block this email address. And they have done that because of the amount of email that passes through the league on a daily basis, especially through all the various lists. Again, I administer DXAC, CAC, and VOAC lists, and there's a number of members on these lists. So if even a third of them started having email problems, we're talking hundreds of messages that can start bouncing and bouncing and bouncing. So to keep that from clogging the system, they have essentially said, okay, you're going to get 9 shots at this, and if that email address, if the mail is, the email is not delivered, then that email address is just going to be blocked and the system will not forward email to it. And what I've seen in my own little world here with the lists that I do, a lot of times if these folks out there, they have changed providers or something like that, but they're still retaining the email address, and now their new system, whatever, is blocking it. So their spam filter, whether it be at their level or their ISP level, is now kicking the mail back. So our system's going, oh, well, this mail's coming back, and I'm now going to keep the timer on it now. And after 9 times or whatever it is they set it to, I think it's 9, I'm just not going to mail to it anymore. They will actually call them and say, well, geez, I'm not getting my posts anymore, and I'm not getting my replies, what have you, and then I can check into it and say, oh, well, this is why, because it's bouncing back as spam. But our system does do that because of just the amount of email that comes through that organization every day.
All right. Well, I don't want to tie Susie's net and yours up here much longer on this subject. We can talk about this later. Would you care to, in 25 words or less, tell me, if we send an email to a particular call sign at AWRL.net, and that is not a registered member in your email service, why should we not get a bounce back telling us that that didn't happen? Over.
Now, that is a good question, and I don't know if I have an answer for it, honestly. I would think that if they were not registered with us, whether they're a member or they've activated it, whatever, that if you send it to, like, K1AAA@arrow.net. If it did not exist, it should have bounced back. Our system would have bounced it back to you saying this person does not exist. So why it doesn't, to be honest with you, I'm not sure. It would be one thing if they did exist on the system and there was an issue. But if they don't exist on the system at all, you would think that it would bounce back to you. And, you know, questions like that, our IT department actually has no problem answering because they know they get this question a lot and they try to answer it. So if you want, maybe, you know, offline at some time, I can probably direct you to somebody in the IT department that can probably better answer that for you. And we'll just let them know, this is why. You're using arrow.net addresses, and yet you don't know. It's almost like you're sending out in the blind whether or not this person actually has that address.
All right. You know, I would like to run this down sometime. It's not primary. It's not at the top of the priority list. But I can assure you, Joe, that I've run some rather exhaustive tests on this. I've taken people that I know, licensed amateurs that are not enrolled in the ARRL email program, and sent them an email purposely at ARRL.net, and it goes to Mars. It never comes back. I don't know if this guy got it or not, but I, you know, in the way that I did it, I know that he wasn't going to get it, but I get no notification. So there's something that's just a little peculiar. Susie, thank you for allowing me to monopolize a number of minutes on your time. KY6V, back to you, Susie.
Oh, no problem, Gordon. This is N1SUZ. These things are also interesting about ARRL. And a lot of times we think of W1AW and ARRL just about operating amateur radio, but there's a lot of stuff that goes behind the scenes, and email addresses and what happens to them is just one part of it. So thank you, Gordon, and thank you, Joe, for covering that. And yes, you might want to connect afterwards and talk more about that if necessary. And now we've got the connection. So let me draw us back into the station. And we talked a little bit about the history of ARRL and the history of W1AW. And for people who haven't been to the station, there's lots of new neat artifacts that you can find into the W1AW building. And maybe, Joe, you could tell us about some of those interesting items that are on display cases and on desks. So, Joe, can you come back and give us a tour of the artifacts?
Okay. Thank you, Gordon. And thank you, Susie. Yes, when you first walk into the station, there's actually kind of two parts. We do have the foyer, which I like to call the historical side of the station to some extent, and then you have the main area where we have more of the modern equipment. In the foyer, we have Old Betsy, which is Hiram Percy Maxim's spark gap generator, or spark gap transmitter, I should say. It's non-functional. It hasn't functioned since 1989 when we had the renovation. It was damaged in transit between conventions. But myself and Bob Allison, WB1GCM, who is our Parkview engineer in the lab, we are someday, when we have free time, going to get Old Betsy up and running. Yes, the mode is illegal, but we can still use it for demonstration purposes. So Old Betsy's in there. Now in front of her is a display case, which has some of the artifacts that survived from the original radio station, and a few other things that I thought would be interesting to the general ham public. At the bottom, we have the old dynamos and generators that were used to develop the AC and DC power at the original station. We have some DeForest receivers in there. We have a few bits of Marconi equipment, a few things like a speaker from the Armstrong family. We actually have another national receiver, which is the same model that was used, which is the NC1, I think it's a higher number, that was used at the original radio station, the original 1AW1MK radio station. And, of course, we have a piece of the old cedar pole that used to hold up our rhombic, because the rhombic came down in 1987. And some QSCs, in fact, I actually have on display there one of our first issues of QSC and a couple of other issues that I thought would be kind of interesting to have. On top of that display case is what looks to be an old amplifier with the final section, very large tubes, very large caps and coils. And at the original station, we actually had a smaller working model of this device. And that was destroyed in flood. But a gentleman who used to remove these from shipboard, because that's what they were used, essentially had a whole garage load of them. He would take them out for the Navy and replace them with new equipment. He donated one to us. Now, on the other side of the foyer is an old roll-top desk. And that was Hiram Percy Maxim roll-top desk. And that was not something that NASA used during his ham times, amateur radio times, or ARL times. That was a gift that he had given to the Haviland family way back in the latter part of the last century, or the early part of the last century. And the family, they were very good friends, the Havilands and the Maxims and so on, and they would have gifts and so on. Well, they gave them, Hiram gave them this roll-top desk. Let me drop it. He gave that roll-top desk to the family, and they just pretty much passed it down to generation to generation. Well, in 2008, the Haviland family pretty much ran out of family to give it to, so they asked us if they would, if we'd like to take it back. And we said, of course, it may not have any amateur radio significance to it, but it was Hiram Percy Maxim's roll-top desk. And what sits on that desk now is our vintage AM station, which consists of an NC-303, and a Johnson Valiant. And that equipment was donated to us by Joe Walsh of the Eagles, W6ACU, and Bob Heil of Heil Sound. And it's there. The equipment's a little flaky. Sometimes it wants to work. Sometimes I have to coax it a little bit. But it's a fully functioning AM station. And for the people who do use it, they're generally on 75 meters talking to the same guys on 75 meters that are always there on 75 AM. Now, on the top end of that shelf, I actually have a straight key and Vibraflex collection. And these keys are functional. I have them functional for visitors that want to use them. And while the CW ops that I have will generally use the paddles that I have in each one of the studios, on occasion, I'll get somebody who wants to use a straight key, and I have a J38, or wants to use a Vibraflex. They have a lightning bug in there. And I pretty much say, you know what? You can adjust it to however you feel, because only you know how you want that key to feel. And thankfully, most of the radios, even though they have built-in keyers, you can disable the keyer, so you can use either the straight key or the Vibraflex. And one of the parts within the foyer is in racks. It's a transmitter. It's our 80-meter transmitter that we'd used up until 1964. It was a homebrew transmitter. Uses an 833. And the thing back then in the early 60s was you knew when that transmitter was on the air because, from what they tell me, the CW King was absolutely crisp with this transmitter. And we had to take it out of service back in 64 only because it was the homebrew. And they were getting newer equipment, newer for the time. And that piece of equipment started to fail. But still on display as an artifact from the early times of W1AW.
Well, thanks, Joe. I enjoyed going through W1AW and looking at all that neat stuff. I did miss the cedar pole, though. I need to go back and take a look at that cornerstone of history. But it seems like there's a lot of donations to the station, as well as upgrades and whatnot. Do you have a partnership with a lot of these companies, or how do your donations work with the new equipment, or do you generally have new equipment replaced every so often?
Well, one quick note on that cedar pole. It's about a foot section. In 1987, in May, it was during Memorial Day, someone, and we're pretty sure it was kids, came through and loosened all the turnbuckles and the towers that were in the back of headquarters that supported part of our rhombic. It was a 20-meter rhombic, and it brought the whole system down. We couldn't afford to replace it, so we had to disassemble it and remove it, and But what they did was they did cut a small section of one of the five cedar poles that held it up, and that's what we have on display there. So when you go and you look at the cabinet, you're looking at it kind of off to the left on the second shelf. As far as donations are concerned, there once was a time when we could almost guarantee getting a donation from manufacturer, but that has changed over the years. Their demand for donations certainly goes up, and they have certain donation budgets. And the only reason I know this is because a few years ago when Kenwood came out with the TS-2000X HF, VHF, and satellite transceiver, I asked them, I said, would you be willing to donate this to the station? And they said, yes, they think they can do it because they have just enough budgeted donation money. And I think we were the last one to get that particular donation for that year. So the donations obviously have dropped over the years. And when it comes to getting equipment, and I pretty much run equipment into the ground almost, I actually have to budget for them. I'm using capital plans and so on. So we actually budget as to when we're going to purchase new equipment. Now, that doesn't mean we never receive donations. Bob Heil, I love that man. He is a very wonderful contributor to W1NW. If I ever need anything, all I can do is just call him and he just sends it in. And just last week, we received from Yaesu their ST-5000. And Dennis Moschenbacher, who used to work for the league, was here last Friday and presented the donation to W1AW. He gave it to Dave Sumner. Being the trustee, he accepted on behalf. And so we do get some donations. Kenwood earlier this year had donated the TS-590 to us as well. But they're certainly down. But again, that's okay. I try to make sure the environment for this equipment is a good environment so it lasts a long time. The equipment's not abused. But again, if we do find we have to purchase something or replace something, we do budget for it.
Well, thank you, Joe. And before I move on, let me open the floor and see if anybody has any questions about what they might see in W1AW, the artifacts there. Anyone have any questions? Come on aboard with your suffix, please.
Six Victor with a short.
Of course, Gordon. Six Victor, come on aboard.
Thanks. I'm just curious. That rhombic that came down because of the kids, you said it was a 20-meter rhombic. How big was it, Joe? Over.
Oh, gosh. I got to think back here now. It's been a while. The rhombic pretty much encompassed the entire area around the building. So 2-5, I would say it was close to 1,100 feet because it started at 1AW. It went out to poles on either side of the station, about 30, 40 feet away. Then it went all the way back, and that's 300 feet or so at least on either side. So you got 600 there. Then it kind of bent a little bit, went to a diamond, and that went into the back. So I would say it was about 1,100 feet, and it was tied off with five-cedar poles, which were the original cedar poles when they first built it, as well as the two towers in the back. And so it was a large thing. And to replace it, it would have meant putting up new towers for it. And now, I was not involved with it at the time, obviously. I was working there, so I knew about it, but I wasn't involved with 1AW at the time. But thinking was that it would have been too costly to repair this massive antenna. And at that time, it was in 87, they were considering renovating W1AW anyway. So I think that was one of the reasons why they opted not to do that.
Boy, you're a man after my heart. You know, a rhombic's not a rhombic until it's 600 feet on a leg, 1,200 feet on each side. What did you have this pointed, east and west, I would assume, from your location, or what?
Yes, this was oriented so we had coverage east and west, and the reason for that was it was used as a bulletin, as a broadcast antenna. Now, that being said, when it wasn't being used for that, visitors did have limited access to it. At the time that it was installed, the tuner for we had feed tubes coming in the top of the shop. The tuner was actually located on the shelf near the window where this was coming in, and they had the line going down into our rack there where you can switch into it. So it wasn't really easy to just, like it is today, to just put a visitor on it. They do have to do a couple of jumper swaps and so on. But it was generally used for our broadcasts, and it had coverage of east to west. Well, you could say west, so we covered pretty much most of the U.S.
Yeah, I hate to tie Susie's program up here, but, you know, with tongue-in-cheek. Of course, it was rotatable, right?
Oh, sure. Sure it was rotatable.
Somewhere in my archives, I've got an article that I wrote a while back that I'll send to you, Joe. You'd get a kick out of it. You know, ever since I was a puppy and wet behind the ears, I dreamed of an antenna farm with a rotatable rhombic, and I came up with a design of railroad tracks and flatbed cars with telephone poles on it, and a full-grown engine pulling this around, the transmitter building right in the middle of this circle. And it can be done if you got lots of money. Go ahead, Susie, KY6V. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Gordon. This is N1SUZ, and this is the TNT special with our special guest, Joe Carcia, station manager for W1AW. And Gordon, I know antennas are close to your heart, so that's all right. And I'm sure Joe is going to describe the antenna farm a little later that W1AW actually has. So now that we've gone and taken a look around, there's lots of equipment in W1AW. You've got the equipment that the bulletins come out of, and you've got the studio equipment. And Joe, why don't you take us into one of the studios? So, or if you'd like, we can visit where the bulletins originate. Your choice, Joe. This is N1SUZ.
Okay, Suzanne, thank you very much. And by the way, I was kidding about the rotating. I know we all know I was kidding. Anyway. Yeah, we'll start with the broadcast stuff. And mind you, I say broadcast because it's purely on a technical level that we broadcast. The equipment we use is pretty much mostly, if not all, for all intents and purposes, amateur-grade equipment. Back in 1989, when we renovated the station, we had purchased Harris transceivers, amplifiers, power supplies, and distribution panels. Now, Harris Corp obviously doesn't sell to hams, but since we are a radio station, a broadcast station, we were able to purchase 7 units, 7 transceivers, amplifiers, etc. And while the equipment ran very well, because it was commercial-grade, heavy-duty, throughout the years, obviously, the equipment started to fail. And we found that repairs were becoming more and more expensive. We wanted to replace the equipment with Harris, but unfortunately, we could no longer afford them. I mean, the cost of a single transmitter, amplifier, and power supply in 1988-89 is nowhere near what it would cost in 2005. And that's okay. We didn't think we were going to go back to Harris, but we wanted to try anyway. But in that interim, we were evaluating amateur-grade equipment. And essentially, there's 4 things we're concerned about: duty cycle, spectral purity, stability, and even transmit TR switch times because of digital and so on. And we were evaluating equipment. We actually had Omnis in there. We had Command Technology amplifiers in there. And we finally settled on ICOMs. We're using ICOM 756 Pro 2s and 3s, which, by the way, we buy. We are not supplied with them. We actually purchase these things. And we found that for that particular application, they worked fine as a transmitter. If Ken Wood or Yaesu were to come up with a comparable model, we'd throw that in there too. The selling point for me, aside from all the specific technical stuff, is the fact they have single hertz tuning. I get retentive when I tell folks that we are exactly on frequency. For example, 20 meters, our CW frequency is 14047.5. Well, if you were to go there and measure us, right there, obviously, we would be at 14047.500 hertz. And you couldn't tell by the display, because I don't necessarily use the display to tell me where we are. I actually use our frequency counter. And that's one of the reasons why we use the ICOM stuff. We're still using a couple of Harris amplifiers left. I've got 2 Ameritrons in there, the AL1200s, as well as 2 PW1s, which are feeding the ICOMs. So we have 7 setups. We're on 7 bands from 160 down through 10 meters. That includes 17. And we're using an ST2800 for our 2-meter transmitter. And that is when you walk in and you go through the foyer, all that equipment is on the right. And it is through a glass door. And let me drop it for a second. Now, the glass door is used for two reasons. First and foremost, keep the sound down, because when those things are running, it is quite noisy. But also, that system also has its own air conditioning unit. And that's obviously to keep the equipment nice and cool. And that's what, in my view, adds longevity. We never let the stuff get very hot. Granted, the equipment has its own features for protection if it gets overly hot, but it doesn't really, because it has its own air conditioning system. In the wintertime, we can turn off the compressor, but we can still use the fan to blow in cool, dry air to keep that equipment nice and cool. That equipment is driven by computers that are used to generate CW. The digital is generated using MixW. The reason we're using that is because I have the versatility of multiple modes. A few years back, we dropped Antornasty. We're still running Ritty. That's still a favorite. But now BPSK31 and MFSK16. And the nice thing about using MixW is if we ever decide, well, let's throw Olivia in there, or maybe a little bit of Feldhell or something like that, I can do that much easier with this particular program. As you may remember, Susan, there's a lot of equipment there as part of the operating console. We can control the transmitters there. We have to manually put them into transmit mode. There has to be somebody physically there at all times while we're transmitting. I mean, in the morning when I'm running a code practice, I can obviously walk over to headquarters for a little bit, but I cannot spend the day there. I have to be back there where the transmitters are. Back to you, Suzanne.
Well, thanks very much, Joe. This is N1SUZ. And yes, it's a very interesting setup there. And one other thing, the power. Do you have a separate power area just in case you lose power so nothing will happen with the operations of the schedules?
Yes, we do. Next to the radio station, there is a fenced-off area, and it actually also houses my north tower, my 60-foot tower. And we have in there a Kohler 60-kilowatt diesel generator. And that generator provides power just to W1AW only. It does not handle the main building. And there is an automatic transfer switch. It is monitoring the line voltage. It tries to match the phase angle if it could before it kicks on. And that has kicked on a couple of times. And even during Hurricane Irene, we had to make sure that it was up and running and that it functioned. The reason I say that is you read in the paper how a number of, or online, that a number of businesses or whatever, hospitals, their generators didn't work when they lost power. And it occurred to me that, well, it took me all of 10 seconds to test my generator to make sure it would feed the station. You mean to tell me these people couldn't test their generator to make sure that it supplied emergency power when it was called for? But that generator, it's been there, it was installed as part of the renovation back in 1989. Aside from having to reset a couple of breakers, resetting the studio breakers because everything trips, and that's part of the protection, it's pretty seamless. Once you hear the big boom, which usually occurs in the winter, you're going to lose power, the power dips, the generator kicks on, and then we have power less than 3 minutes later.
Very good, Joe. That's good to know. And also, it seems as though that's improved over the years, because back in, I guess, 1936, there was a hurricane that the power went out, and there was nothing to back it up at W1AW. But maybe we'll talk a little bit about that later. All right, so we have a studio. We have lots of great equipment. And can you talk to us about the studios? You have 3 studios in there. One's devoted to digital, one to 40 meter, and one to 20 meter. And we went into the 40 meter room. I wanted to go to 20, but someone was in there. And I'm really fascinated about the digital room. And that's something that I'm sure has changed over the years, and I'm sure that wasn't there many years ago either. So can you describe the studios for us, Joe?
Oh, sure can. We have three studios, and I think when you guys came, the reason I put you on 40 in the third studio was simply because I had a visitor in the first studio. I can mix and match any band in any one of the studios. Prior to the renovation, we had spots that were the 80-meter spot, the 50-meter spot, and that was it. But now, with the three studios, I essentially have up to 7 HF operating positions. And whether I put somebody on 20 meters on the FT9000 or on the TS590 in Studio 3, we can kind of mix and match that. But each studio has at least 2 HF operating positions. The first studio, that's the one when you walk into your left, has an ICOM IC7700 and the FTDX9000. I also consider that my contesting studio, which is why the high-end radios are in there. The second studio, we have our Flex 5000 and ICOM IC7000 and the TS2000X. And that studio has our HRS station, our Winlink, our 2-meter Winlink system on there. We have the Runarmis packet. And, of course, we run satellite from there as well with the TS2000. The third studio has an ICOM IC76 Pro 2, which shares a computer with the FT2000, and that's the radio I had you guys on. And next to that now is the new Kenwood TS590S. Now, in the main area, nearest the door, is what I call my digital station, and that's where I run the two D-Star radios. I have an ICOM ID1, which is 23 centimeters, and an ICOM IC2820 for 2 and 70. I also have our Mars station there, as well as our Echolink, our conference server. I access it from that as well. And when I do HF Winlink, like when I'm connected to a PMD or something like that, I will use that station there. And also look at the station as an old Roden Schwartz XL2100 transceiver, which they joke is pretty much a spectrum analyzer with an antenna on it. And that's there if the hands want to use it. Sometimes I'll use it to monitor signals either from visitors or if I'm asked to listen to something. And across from that, it's a very nondescript station. It's essentially a computer with a FT2800 next to it, and that is our ROP transmitter. We run a node 4292, which is used mostly for MCOM use, but it's there in case folks want to talk to us, at least during lunchtime, through ROP.
Well, I have to say it was really interesting to operate from W1AW, and my preferred mode is 20, but yes, someone was in that room, and we needed to do a different setup there. But tell me, Joe, do you get a lot of people who go in there and want to work the digital studio?
On occasion, I don't get too much call for it. I do have some regulars. There's a couple guys from Manchester that will come in, and one or two from New York that will come in, and they may run PSK31 or just regular RTTY. There's not a lot of call for it. And obviously, I never push anything on anyone. I want the visitors to be very comfortable when they come in. And so I pretty much will give them their choice. If someone says, I want to run digital, I'll say, okay, well, I've got my 7700, my 9000. Those are geared for digital, and I give them the choice. My FT2000 and TS590S are not wired for digital yet. I just have to build additional interfaces for those. And on that note, I build all the interfaces, the digital interfaces, for the station. Yes, it's easy to go out and buy them, but I like to build them. I like visitors to know that there's still building going on at W1AW. But there's just not a lot of call for it. Most of the time, the visitors come in, like I had visitors today, and they want to get on 20 meters, 20-meter phone, and that's fine. What's important to me is as long as they've had a good time operating, they leave there satisfied, they leave there happy, and And if it meant just running 20-meter foam, that's cool with me.
Oh, very good, Joe. Yes, 20-meter foam, I guess I'm guilty of enjoying that, too. And I like the idea that you built those interfaces. And you're a pretty handy guy, because later I'm going to ask you about that Oscar 1 that you helped rebuild. And we'll talk about that a little later. So, well, can you tell us what the guidelines, visitor operating guidelines are before we move on? Because that's pretty important to people who want to visit, too.
Okay. Aha, Oscar 1. Oh, my gosh, that was a headache. But we got it working. Anyway, essentially, even though the FCC says you do not necessarily need to have your license with you, we still ask to see a copy or the original of your amateur radio license. Now, that being said, we do have folks that have visited from, say, California, and may not have it with them, and we will look them up on QRZ. I will never turn anyone away for not having their license with you, but we do check. So we ask you to have your license or copy of it with you. You can operate on those bands and modes granted by your particular license class. So as I tell folks, whether you're a novice or an extra, I will probably have a spot here for you. Now, you would only use the station call sign WNW only. Since it is a memorial station, that rule has been set down for decades. And that rule actually applies to staff. As station manager, I cannot use my personal call sign in that station. Even the trustee will not use his personal call sign in that station unless he actually gives his permission to do so. So all the contacts, all the calls are made using strictly W1AW. And even on that note, I tell hands that you can't kind of sneak a contact. For example, say you're working VU4RB and you happen to work them from W1AW, you can't sort of sneak in there, oh, by the way, my call is NJ1Q, can you put me in the log too? That's not how it works. So we essentially say it's only W1AW. I mean, if folks ask your call, that's fine, but I leave it to the visitors to understand that they're operating and acting as W1AW, and that should really be the only call that's making the contacts. I mean, yes, it benefits the station because we tend to make a lot of contacts and it raises our contact total and our war total. But it's not for that. It is because it's a memorial station. It's in honor of Hiram Percy Maxim, and so they can only operate as W1AW. Now, depending upon the band, there are some areas that I recommend my visitors avoid. For example, on 20 meters, I usually will tell visitors to avoid 14230 to 236 because that's the SSTV digital segment. That's not to say that only SSTV or digital imaging is allowed there. It's just that operating as W1AW, visitors become a bigger target. And if a visitor, for example, asks that 14233 if the frequency isn't used, and they ask if the frequency is used, no one comes back, they'll get on, start making contacts, and so on. Within a few minutes, and this has happened on more than one occasion, by magic, there happens to be a digital image signal there. And, oh, by the way, they were there all the time. W1AW, you are interrupting and interfering with my transmission. It's a little childish. It's a very teeny, tiny minority of the SSTV and digital imaging group. But because that has happened on more than one occasion, let me drop it for a second. Because that has happened to my visitors on more than one occasion, I just tell them just avoid that area completely. I also tell them to avoid the band edges because you can never truly rely on the display to tell you where you are exactly on frequency, and to avoid areas of established activity, and to be overtly polite. W1AW is under more scrutiny than any other station that I can think of, and therefore, you have to be overtly polite. If you find a clear frequency and you start calling CQ, and usually I bang up the power for you so you have a relatively loud signal, and someone says, gosh, 1AW, you're like a kilohertz and a half away from our net, can you please move? I instruct my visitors, if that happens, just say, okay, thank you, and just move right off. I try to impress upon the visitors that even though you're operating as 1AW, you in some respects have even less right, if you will, to a frequency than anybody else for that reason, because we are under more scrutiny, and that you should try to find a nice, clear spot where you can sit there and operate, because generally, as happens most times, as operators 1AW, as you found out, Sue, a pileup can start very quickly. Logging is all done by computer. I use WriteLog for generic logging, because I upload the stuff to Logs of the World. But for contesting, we use N1MM Logger. But all logging is done by computer. And the QSL procedure is pretty easy. I tell my visitors, those are folks they contact if they ask, to just QSL directed to please include a self-addressed send envelope, nothing else. Foreign hands, if they don't want to go direct, they can QSL by the Bureau. And I'm the guy that fills out all the cards. Well, the computer prints them out, and I stick the labels. But we do QSL anyone who requests the card from us. Back to you.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. This is N1SUZ. I found it really fascinating, and I did find it an honor to work the W1AW station. And we were polite, and we had a big pileup after everyone discovered W1AW was on where we were located. So it was a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed it. So let me break with you for a moment, and first let me pick up Gordon, and I also have Terrence, KJ4ZMV, who wants a comment. But Gordon, you've been very patient. Go ahead with your comment, Gordon, KY6V.
Hey, thanks, Susie. And thank you. You know, the real honor here tonight is to have you with us, Joe, KY6V. This pileup that Susie's talking about running W1AW that had nothing to do with the female voice that she's got, I'm sure. I wanted to take you back to that 60kW genset that you've got. I imagine it's on a pad, probably a standard setup outside, and tell you just a quick story to put a smile on your face, Joe. You know, I went through Andrew down in Miami in the early 90s. I was in charge of a TV station down there for CBS. We had all kinds of backup, Joe. I mean, we had automatic switching between substations. We had a room that had a 24-foot wall that was loaded with UPS equipment that would carry this 200kW transmitter for 20 minutes off a battery. We had a 500kW brand spanking new Onans on the pad outside. Andrew comes in, power goes down, ups comes up, we don't miss a lick. Generator turns on, generator runs for, I don't know, probably about a half an hour, and all of a sudden it goes down. Soup panel, you know, supervisory panel on the wall, Joe says, we're indicating shutdown for overrun. And we're scratching our heads. Shut down for overrun? All right, well, then the tower came down. You know, all heck went loose, and we went black, and we were down. When we figured it out, Joe, this emergency generator sitting out on the pad, brand spanking new, didn't have 50 hours on it. Had an air cooling cowling over the top of it, you know, with the vents on the side. When Andrew came in, the velocity of that wind, and that was a Cat 5, blew through those vents, spun up the fan on the generator. The generator says, "You got me going too fast," and shut it down. Now, how do you figure that one, Joe? Over.
Wow. All I can say is, ouch. Not ever having that happen there, I can only imagine, and I can see that happening, because our generator has a number of safeguards built into it, and overrun is one of them, at least according to the panel on the wall, it shows that, but I find that most impressive, and all I can say to that is it's Mother Nature. She will do whatever she wants.
Yeah, well, at any rate. I don't know what you do about it, because you need cooling in there, too. I guess you need to have a rotator on that pad where you can swing it so the wind's coming in endwise instead of broadside or something. Susie, go ahead and pick up Terrence, and thank you. KY6V, over.
Well, thank you, Gordon. And We always love your stories, Gordon. They're great. And thank you again, Joe. Okay, I'm going to call out to Terrence, KJ4ZMV, one of our great NCSs here on South Cars. Terrence, come on aboard with your question or your comment for Joe.
Well, thank you, Susan. You're the great one. I love your voice, no doubt. It's a great block instruction, Joe. Man, you... It's a lot going on with ARLL, with the ARRL. I'm not currently a member, but that's going to change, I guess, soon enough. But I got a question. All those old antique radios that's sitting in the lobby, do you guys ever get a chance to use those radios, or, you know, do those radios make a cameo appearance on the airways, or... are they just there for display purposes only now? And also, do you guys have free memberships for free magazines? No, I'm only kidding. But the question was just basically, do you guys use those antique radios at any time? Over.
Oh, good evening, Terrence. Interesting question. I would have to defer to our circulation for that. Aye. And a quick note, I know you said you're not a member, but, and I kind of mentioned this to Gordon last night when we were talking, and I should have said this when I was talking about operating 1AW. 1AW is open to all licensed hams, regardless of membership. I don't check for membership. I don't become a horrific... show for headquarters and say, well, geez, you really should be a member. I don't do that because when I was a little Johnny novice many years ago and I was involved in my school club, I would call the station a lot, and obviously I could not afford to be a member. I would call up W1AW, and the manager there at the time, who was Chuck Bender, WNWPR, who since passed away, would always help me. He would always help me, and I can just, thinking back now, the look in his face would have been, oh my gosh, here's this little kid calling me again, asking for help, but he always took the time to help me. And that stayed with me, and I felt, you know what, that is something that needs to be carried on. The fact that the radio station for W1W is here for the amateurs in general. We're located, my manager is the manager of the membership services department, but it's not a membership service. It's there for all hands. I should have said that, and I want to say that, and thank you, actually, Terrence, for kind of reminding me to say that. As for the equipment, unfortunately, a lot of stuff is purely for display. It hasn't been active, hasn't been powered up for decades, literally for decades, so I can just imagine that the caps in these things are completely dried out. With a lot of old radios, with the cotton wire that they use, the cotton insulation, and so on, a lot of it is dried and has flaked. So they are there pretty much for display purposes. Now, we do have a few radios that are located actually in storage that are functional. You probably want to put them on a rheostat and bring them up real slow. But those radios that are on display in the lobby, they're purely for display purposes. And that whole lobby comes out of back in 1999 when we redid the lobby. We had our museum there, and we felt we still needed to have something on display there, so they moved them in there. But unless someone would come along and actually volunteer to recondition all of them, they'll probably never see an electron in their life again.
Hey, Roger on that. Just curious, because the beautiful radios, and you know, I do know, coming from a CB era, you know, and I kind of like gradually came into ham radio. I haven't been a ham that long, and you know, you hear the stories about these old antique CB radios, like the Brownie Golden Eagles, and they would have a distinctive sound, you know, when you key them up. And, you know, so that was the reason why I was asking the question, because I'm sure these old tube-type radios, you know, would also have a very distinctive sound, you know, and feel, you know, when you squeeze the mic, no doubt. Joe, appreciate it. KJ4, Zulu Mike Victor, back to net control.
Well, thanks very much, Terrence. That was a great question. And we love those old radios, don't we? And thank you very much. And thank you, Joe, for answering that. So we've gone to the operating guidelines. And one of the things that we love to do when we're operating there is look at those big antennas. And W1AW has an antenna farm out and back. And Joe, could you tell us about the antennas? And a lot of South Cars guys out there are into antennas, and I'm sure they're going to enjoy hearing what you've got out there. When I covered my visit to the ARRL, I wanted to save the descriptions for you. So, Joe, come on aboard if you can, and let's hear about them antennas. This is N1SUZ to NJ1Q.
N1SUZ, NJ1Q for ID. Sorry, throw that in there. Okay, well, we're not like a lot of other contest stations. It's impressive because we have four towers, three 60-footers and one 120-foot, which is 165. But it's funny, compared to some hams, it's pretty small. But anyway, pretty much most of the antennas are used both for broadcast and for visitors are M-squared antennas. They were replaced back in August and early September of 2006. We had actually purchased 23 different antennas, because we're using stuff back from the renovation. And we knew we would have to replace the antennas. Something occurred in February of 06 that kind of pushed that up, and that was essentially the element of one of our 20-meter antennas came down in a small ice storm and impaled itself 3 feet into the ground. So we said, you know what, we have to replace the antennas this year. So in 06, we replaced them with M-squared antennas. They're all the Survivor series. And we have commercial antennas for 40 meters down through 1296. And we even have an old barbecue grill in there from SSB Electronics. For 80 meters, I have a four-wire cage that I built about 11 years ago. I have to replace that. That's used for 80 meters for the broadcast. It's also used for visitor operations. I built the cage simply because I need the bandwidth. The Harris amplifiers is at the time when I was using a Harris on 80. Are extremely critical about their load. And at the time we were using, I had made folded dipoles, coaxial resonators, and I wasn't happy with those. So I decided on a cage antenna, which gave me the bandwidth. So we have a cage for 80, and we have a dipole for 80 that's oriented east-west. We get north-south coverage. We have a dipole for 160, which is set at the top of the 125th tower. And then that's also used for broadcast and for visitor operations. We have five elements on 20 meters, four elements on 40. We also have four elements on 10 meters and four elements on 15 meters. On 17, we have three. We have three element antennas. And I actually have two sets of antennas. I have what I call my broadcast antennas, which generally are located on the 125th tower. And then I have the visitor antennas. So in many respects, I have two antennas for every band, and even for 80, you can say. The nice thing about that is if, for whatever reason, my 17-meter broadcast antenna fails, I can always switch to the visitor 17-meter antenna, orient it towards the west to cover the U.S., and I'm still on the air on that particular frequency. Now, for 6 meters, we're running the M-squared 9KHR, which is the 9-element. And for, let me drop it here for a second. For satellite use, we're running cross Yagis for 2 and 70 centimeters, which are getting a little longer, too. Those have to be replaced pretty soon. Just the 23-element Yagi for 23 centimeters. And the barbecue grill is for 2.4 gigs. And I installed that for AO40, when that poor bird was up there, for the downlink frequency. There's a downlink microwave converter on that that converts it down to 2 meters. And, of course, we have a dipole up there for 60, although there's not a lot of call for it. We have AA isopoles that I use for packet cluster use when necessary, but for APRS and for my D-Star work as well. And those are pretty much spread out right next to the station, again, on the four towers. There's Andrews Happens hardline feeding all of them. In some cases, I have LMR 600 for LMR 400 feeding something as well. If it's not a, if it's not an antenna, I would say is important, specifically being used for broadcast or for visitors, I would probably not waste the hard line on it, but use something hefty like 400 or maybe even 600. But half inch Andrews going into the antenna boxes, and these boxes are polyphages, which are grounded, and from there, more hard line is the conduit which goes into the main building. The antennas, when we assemble them, and I can say with confidence that I built 80% of them, it was a massive antenna party. It was, again, it was in August of 06. I had assistance from a number of lab staff, and the building manager helped us, as well as one or two other staffers, and we pretty much spent 2 weeks just assembling these antennas and having them installed. Because we are a station, the insurance requires us to have a certified tower installer, tower antenna installer. So I actually use Matt Strelo, KC1XX, out of Mason, New Hampshire. He is a certified climber. His business is XX Towers, and that's what he does. He installs towers, installs antennas. He does it for hams. He does it for commercial, and so on. So if I ever have an issue, he'll come down and check it out for me. Let me drop this for a second. Now, we're also required to have inspections, and twice a year Matt will come down and with a crew, and they will inspect all the towers and all the antennas. And that is actually moved over to WNHQ, the station, the headquarters station. He will also inspect those antennas as well. And if anything needs to be replaced, usually it's hardware, or sometimes it's a coaxial jumper or whatever, he'll let me know, and if I'm fortunate enough, I can get the jumper, the pigtail, or even the hardware right to him that same day, and he can fix it. And that's good liability. We're technically not allowed to climb our own towers. I'm not sure who on this conference server might be working in the insurance industry, but that's what they want. They really don't want non-licensed, non-insured individuals walking up these towers, even though we probably could. And that's fine, because it takes the liability off us. And I can, and I know that when Matt does the work, he does it well. In fact, in July of 1998, the bottom section of the 120-foot tower had to be replaced because it was rotting out. And one day, Matt came down with a large crew, rented a crane, and replaced that bottom section of the Roan 120-foot tower, and it was flawless. Everything went as clockwork, so I have a great deal of confidence in him doing the work for the station as well as for the headquarters.
Well, thank you, Joe, for sharing that. This is N1SUZ. And yes, I wouldn't be going up on those towers myself because I'm afraid of heights, but we do have quite a few antenna people on air here who do walk up those towers, and George is one of them, KW4LCB. But let me open up to the floor now and see if anyone has any comments or questions. And Gordon, come on right ahead if you're there.
Thanks, Susie. Six Victor.
Go right ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, just a quickie. Joe, I'm very familiar with your insurance comments and licensing comments. You know, when Susie and Paul had the pleasure of visiting your palace up there, she came back and she had taken quite a bit of pictures of the antenna arrays and so on and so forth. The first thing that caught my mind is that a lot of the upper HF antennas, the beams, appeared to be fixed in a particular location. I'm sure favoring to wherever you need to broadcast, but my question is, do you also have rotatable, like 20-meter antennas, 17, that kind of thing, Joe, over?
Yes, we do. I have four towers, three 60-footers and one 120, but there are essentially rotators on all four of the towers. My north and south towers, the shorties, they have rotators, and my 120-foot has rotators, and rotatable HF antennas, and those are for visitor use. For example, on the top of the 120-foot is a rotatable 40 and 20-meter. On my south tower, We have 12, 15, and 30 meters. And by the way, the 30 meters is a full-size three-element 30. So we, even though we're running 200 watts, we have a decent signal there. And of course, on the north tower, we have the 6, 2, 70 centimeter, 10 meters, and 17 meters. And those are all rotatable. And again, those are for visitor use. On the 125th tower, the fixed antennas, those are used, yes, primarily for broadcast. And they are fixed in such a way to favor pretty much the west. What we had done was, after this last antenna upgrade back in 06, I asked Dean Straub, who N6BV, who is one of our antenna gurus, to pretty much model them for us based upon the height and so on to give us a favorable coverage of the U.S. Now, granted, it's not perfect because obviously I, short of putting a humongous compass setting rose points on the ground, my contractor was able to orient antennas and kind of use additional side mounts to kind of orient these things in such a way to give us coverage. But we told him what kind of coverage we want, and he had to take into account the fact that these have only certain beam widths to them, and what would be the kind of sort of best way to get these things to overlap, so where I would have coverage of pretty much most of the U.S. And I would say, for the most part, on most of the bands, at least 20, 40, 20, and 15, I have really good coverage of the U.S. The 80-meter cage, and it's pretty much just a logistics thing, I didn't have very many places I could mount it, has an east-west coverage to it. So I don't think the folks down in Florida will necessarily hear us too well on 80. They might. We might be a little weak. Yes, we have the visitor antennas that are rotatable for the visitors, but also to fix up or use for our bulletins and code practice.
Yeah, I rather suspected that was the case. Thank you very much, Joe. Would you care to comment for just a moment on the cage antenna for 75? Is that a full 120 feet, like a half-wave dipole? With just a caged wire section for broadbanding, or what kind of construction is that, sir? Over.
Okay. Yeah, I have to admit that the cage, I get a lot of comments and questions about that. And probably because, at least today's ham, and I don't mean that disparagingly, but generally they know about dipoles and those sorts of and long wires and what have you. So I think the cages may have just fallen out of people's sight. But essentially it is just four 80-meter dipoles set at the center, terminated at the ends, and they terminate at the center as well, with a 3-foot spacing on them. And they use PVC, like a PVC cross piece in the center to keep them separated. Now it is slightly shorter. The nice thing about getting that 3-foot radiator is that it's actually about a foot and a half shorter than your standard size 80-meter dipole. There's no appreciable gain to it because essentially it's just a dipole. We're talking 2.15. But it does give me the bandwidth because now the radiator, the antenna thinks, or the transmitter thinks that the radiator is now 3 feet wide. So I do get pretty good bandwidth out of it. Its absolute resonant point is around 3627 kilohertz. But at the bottom of 80, and by that I mean my CW frequencies, which is 3581.5, the SWR is about 1.6. At the top end, around 3990, which is our phone frequency, the SWR is about 1.8, 1.9. I could have probably gotten those numbers a little better, but I like to get the antenna to the point where at least the Harris amplifier is happy. And by that I mean it's pretty much dumping as much power as it could. There's no cutback. It's not going into reduced power and overtemp. And with any antenna that I have to build, I always have the Harris amplifiers in mind because my first priority is the fact that it could be used for broadcast. And again, when I built these, I was using all Harris amplifiers. But also the Harris amplifiers, being power MOSFETs, they're extremely critical about their load. Excuse me. So if the load is good, the amplifier is good, and I know the antenna is working relatively efficiently.
Yeah, just great information. I hope that the audience is picking up on that cage environment too, Joe. 3 feet in circumference is quite a bit. My goodness gracious. Back in my early days when I was a kid, a teenager, I built a four-element beam for 10 meters, Joe, and I made a squirrel cage out of the driven element. And as I recall, it was something like maybe 6 inches in diameter. And I'll tell you what, I could tune the bottom end of 10 meters clear up to the top end, and not I'd be 1.1 in the middle and maybe 1.3 on both ends of the band. It just works great. Back to you, Susie. Maybe we can cover that on the 8th of September. KY6V, over.
Well, thanks very much, Gordon, and thank you, Joe. Yes, the 8th of September, Gordon is hosting a TNT on antennas. He's the man with antennas. So thanks very much. And I've got Terrence, who has a comment and or a question. So Terrence, KJ4ZMV, come on aboard and get your question out to Joe.
Hey, thanks again, Sue. Appreciate it. Gordon, I would love to know about making these antennas. That sounds interesting, very interesting topic, making antennas, and especially that beam antenna. I'm very interested in that. Joe, question. The abilities of the, if you could, just elaborate a little bit on the satellite antenna or the satellite tower that you built there and its rotating ability now. I only thought that towers or beams or antennas themselves would just rotate on an azimuth, but this one actually has the tilting ability to track satellites. So if you could just talk about that a little bit. Back to you, Joe. KJ4 Zulu, Mike Victor.
Okay, Terrence. One quick note. The 80-meter cage, I can't take full credit for it. It is based upon an article that appeared in December 1980 issue of QST. At the time, I was looking for a broadband antenna, and I came across this article. And I did have to modify it for my use. In other words, I had to beef up the antenna because I couldn't be like in the offices, just fix it whenever. But it's based on the design from that article in the December 1980 issue of QST. On the subject of the satellite antennas, yes, generally my rotatable antennas are strictly azimuth. I use M-squared RC2800 rotators. They're heavy-duty rotators, and as Sue can attest, there's a control console in each studio. But for the satellites, we have azimuth, but we also have elevation control, and what we use is the Yaesu G5500 AZL rotator setup. You get an azimuth rotator, you get an elevation rotator, which kind of looks like the old style TV type antenna rotators, but flipped on its side, but painted green. And that we use for elevation. And the control box actually has the 2 meters and 4 push buttons on it for raising and lowering for the elevation, and of course swinging the antenna around back and forth. Now for tracking, we normally use Nova for Windows or Orbitron, and I'm using an interface which was built as part of the League's Education Technology Program. It's a PIC USB type tracking device that interfaces between the controller and the computer. So essentially I tell the program, in this case Nova for Windows or Orbitron, I'm using this type of rotator control, this type of interface. And when I pick on the satellite, it essentially tells the controller when and when to start tracking the satellite. Obviously, there is a calibration procedure involved, but once you get that down, it works pretty good, and you can be within a couple of degrees. Now, granted, at VHF and even more so at UHF, a couple of degrees can make all the difference in the world, especially with satellites. 5 degrees above the horizon, you're probably being into a tree, at least where we are. But overall, it works very well. But we use the Yaesu G5500 rotator setup. Back to you, Terrence.
Hey, Roger on that, Joe. And a follow-up question, is this particular setup Is it for the public too, or is it just for maybe just the staff there and the research team? But is this particular satellite set up for the public to come in and actually get a feel for it, and they could actually use it if there's a satellite in the area? Back to you, Joe.
Oh, sure. In fact, this is part of one of my visitor setups. It is the satellite station. Now, right now, the radio I'm using, the TS-2000X, which is, while it's a wonderful, wonderful radio, unfortunately has a birdie right on the downlink frequency of AO-27 and SO-50. So unfortunately, those two birds are not usable from W1AW. But yes, usually I will have an occasional visitor that wants to run the station. Now, obviously, it's only good if there's a satellite pass and it's a decent one. And W1AW is actually in the hole. We're only 77 feet above sea level. We are in what's called the Connecticut Pioneer Valley. Essentially, this whole area where we're located dropped millions of years ago. And as Sue can attest, you can see one edge of the ridge near what's called Avon Mountain, and the other end is where Trinity College is, and everything else in between just kind of fell. So we're like in this hole. So when it comes to the height above horizon and so on, if a satellite's only going to be 4 or 5 degrees above the horizon, it's really not usable for us. If we were out, say, in the Midwest, where everything's pretty much flat, that's a different story. So there's not always the availability of various satellites. Sometimes the good passes occur very late in the day. Sometimes they occur very early in the morning, and they may not occur during visitor operating time because we do have code practice in the morning. So sometimes it is actually just hit or miss if we have a good pass. There are times if I'm doing some experimentation or I just want to try to activate the satellite station to blow the dust off it, I'll get on during lunch hours if there is a decent pass. But again, yeah, that station is for visitor use.
Hey, Roger on that, Joe. And one more question, and then I'm going to get back to net control. Survivability as far as the antenna, this is a massive farm. And with the inclement weather that we have, you know, in various parts of the country, hurricanes and tornadic activity, what type of damage have these antennas ever sustained, if any, or how do they, you know, they thin in the weather conditions? Over.
Well, aside from the satellite antennas and my homebrew antennas, and of course a few other smaller ones, the M-squared antennas of the Survivor series, so they're rated for 125 mile per hour winds. Not that I ever want to test that, but that's what they're rated for. And the towers themselves are rated for about 65 to 85 miles an hour, depending upon whether or not it's a guide tower, the height, and, of course, the wind load that's put on them. On that note, I would say that if I wanted to put a very safe number on, say, my 120-foot tower, because of the amount of antennas on there, and because of the wind load, I would say it can probably survive maybe a 65 to 70 mile an hour. I can say sustained. I think if it was a sustained 85 mile an hour, I think we would probably see some structural wear and tear simply because of the load that's on it. The other towers, again, also rated for about 65 to 85. I think because they don't have as much of the load, they would probably survive. Now, that being said, because there is a lot of plumbing up there on very long masts, I think a very good sustained wind, hurricane force at least, would probably bend it and damage it. The antennas themselves, it wouldn't matter, because as soon as the mast failed, it would be this domino effect. You'd have things falling on, you'd have antennas falling on other antennas, and you would increase their wind load, so now you've got more mass for the wind to push, and it would just fail in one horrible mess. So I do rely on the manufacturers, and even the insurance company relies on what the manufacturer's specs are. But again, we have to take into consideration the additional wind load that the antennas put on them. Knock on wood, we did fairly well with Irene. We have had very strong thunderstorms come through throughout the years. We have had microbursts, straight line winds. Knock on wood, we've never had tornadoes. And the towers, at least 120 foot, did survive Gloria back in 1985. And again, I never want to test the strength of these things. And as sounds, that's one of the reasons why we have to carry the insurance on them, because we can never guarantee that we won't have something so catastrophic. Like Irene, if it came out as a Category 2 or even a 3, I think it would have seen some damage. But at least I know that the way they are set up right now, they can probably sustain short bursts of high-speed wind. Back to you.
Hey, Roger on that, Joe. Wow, it's very impressive. You know, knock on wood, and I was knocking, that we definitely don't want anything to happen to the antennas. Man, NJ1Q, appreciate it, Joe. KJ4, Zulu Mike Victor, back to N1SUZ.
Well, thank you very much, Terrence. Another great question for Joe, and it is now 2 hours into our program, and we have a little bit left to go, but let me ask you, Joe, if you're still up for finishing up what we wanted to cover tonight. Do you have any more time for us?
Oh, sure. Not a problem at all.
Very good, Joe. Thanks very much. Didn't want to occupy you too long if you needed to get going. So, all right. Let me open up the floor just one more time and see if anybody has any additional questions on the antenna forum before we move on. And we've got some great stuff coming up that are moving us into the 21st century. Okay, anybody else have any questions about antennas? Come right ahead with your suffix, please. All right. Nothing heard. I guess we're going to move on. And W1AW has a lot of capabilities besides just operating single sideband and whatnot. We have IRLPs, Echolink, WL2K, Mars, etc. Joe, can you go over some of that with us? Some of this stuff I didn't realize. I wasn't really familiar with WL2K. That sounds really interesting to me, but can you come ahead and describe some of all these other capabilities that your station has?
Okay, thank you, Suzanne. Yes, these capabilities, it's a mixture of both visitor use as well as just station use. We'll start off with IRLP. A few years back, when there were incidences like hurricanes and so on going on, if in an affected area someone was running RLP node, well, what we used to do is we would go to the local repeater group that ran an RLP node and said, geez, can we use your node for a little while to monitor the situation? And they'd say yes, of course, but it got to the point where we were always asking them, and so the decision was to pretty much install our own RLP node, since we knew it would be used primarily for MCOM work. We said, okay, let's just go through the paces, go through the motions, and develop our own RLP node, so which we did. I went through, talked to the guys up in Canada, told them what we wanted to do. They said, sure, just fill out the paperwork, give us your call sign, frequency, and we'll assign a node number to you. And so we now have our own RLP node, again, which is 4292. We run it really high up on 2 meters. It's on a simplex frequency. And again, it's used mostly for MCOM use, but usually during the lunch hour, I will just turn it on in case anybody wants to just come in and chat and say hi. And it's opened in that while you need a PL to activate it, visitors don't necessarily need to use any additional tone. For example, today I had a visitor from Michigan. He wanted to talk to his friends back home. So I gave him the mic and told him, type in your 4-digit RLP node and away you go. And sure enough, he did. He had a nice time. He actually scheduled some time on 20 meters to talk to his friends back home, and they did that. So it's there for MCOM use, but also for just regular visitor use as well. Of course, the Echolink, we run a conference server, W1AWBDCT, which we use to upload our audio from all of our CW and digital of transmissions, our code practice bulletin and transmissions. I haven't configured it yet for our nightly phone bulletin. That's eventually coming. But anyone, it's open. If they want to just connect to us and monitor our code, practice our digital transmissions, they can do that in real time. It runs concurrently with our regular transmissions. And I did that in part for those fans that just cannot refuse if they ever want to listen to it. Whether or not they're copying code, is that's not the requirement. Some of them just like to listen to it. So that's there as well. But I also have EchoLink just in general for folks who want to use that to talk to their friends. Now the WL2K, excuse me, that's WinLink 2000. And let me drop it here for a second, please. The WL2K, WinLink 2000, is a system of using PacTrol 1, 2, and 3 for sending email over HF. And it's not just something that you just do. You actually have to get into the WinLink system. And the call signs are pretty straightforward. In this case, ours is w1aw@winlink.org. Excuse me. And we did that mostly for MCOM use. We did not set that up for just casual operating for people to send and receive email. We did that mostly, if not primarily, for MCOM use, to where if we were to lose email in any particular situation, we would still have, or lose internet, I should say, we still have an outlet for getting email out of ARRL headquarters. And we would do that using PacTor. PacTor, again, 1, 2, and 3. And that system, the HF side of that, is actually located on the digital station, which is located near the front door. Now, the other side of that is the 2-meter side, which is we use RMS packet, which consists of a 2-meter radio and a TNC. We run a 2-meter node on 145.510, the call is WAW-10, where people using PacLink or RMS packet can connect to us to also send and receive email using like a WinLink address. With most both systems, excuse me, you can send email, just generic email, like w1aw@winlink.org can send an email to joham@arl.net. Through this system. And that, again, is not so much set up for visitors, but as more of a service and for MCOM use as well. The Mars station, we are a licensed Mars station. Excuse me. Alpha Alpha 1 November Radio. Alpha Alpha Radio 1 November Radio. And that also was done primarily for MCOM use. And we usually check in once in a great while, depending upon whether or not there's anything going on. For example, we have a system ready to check in to MarsNet during Hurricane Irene, but we didn't need to do that. And back over to you, Susan.
Well, thanks very much, Joe. That was really a good description of all those capabilities. And it just goes to show you that we are in the 21st century with W1AW, because a lot of this stuff is new technology. IRLP, Internet Radio Linking Project, MCOM, which is Emergency Communications, WL2K is the WinLink 2000 Worldwide Radio Messaging System, and MARS, which is the Military Auxiliary Radio System, where the civilian auxiliary assists the military in communications. But thanks so much for describing those things. And we've got some comments and some questions. And first let me pick up Gordon, KY6B, because he's got the first comment. Gordon, come on aboard.
Thank you, Susie. Joe, KY6B here. You know, I picked up my ears on the IRLP. I don't know how familiar you are at this entrance point with South Cars, Joe, but our server that you're currently connected to is up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's a state-of-the-art server sitting on a main major internet hub linking Chicago to Grand Rapids, multiple fiber optic feeds and so on. This baby is currently set at 2,000 simultaneous connects, and we can throw a switch and take you to 10,000 if we need the room, and we have the bandwidth to do that. This server, Joe, is currently set up for both EchoLink entrance and IRLP. IRLP node number is 96 1-4. And strangely, and by design, our Echolink node number is 96140. So you could take your W1AW IRLP system and connect to our server on 96.14, and you would be into the South Cars family, and we would love to have you anytime you want to do that, Joe. Over.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Gordon. Thank you. Well, the issue with IRLP, and you probably heard me saying it throughout the course of the conversation, during lunch. And the reason I have to make that distinction is, even though I'm manager, I'm also paid staff, and so technically, we cannot operate when we're on the clock. So at any time I'm doing anything RF-wise, whether it be HF, IRLP, and so on, I have to do it when I'm not on the clock. And that's so we can keep in line with the rules and regulations set forth by the FCC. Now that kind of, I know I'm going off a little bit of a tangent here, it's kind of along the lines of 97.113, but otherwise I usually do not have the RLP node on, and whether we're just doing casual constant visitor operating or anything like that, I usually only have it on if it's not during emergency times, during the lunch hour. But other than that, I think that would be kind of fun to do, because again, the system is there, and therefore visitor use if necessary, in addition to the MCOM.
Oh, I understand that completely, Joe. Thank you. We are very close to adding into the family All-Star and Asterisk as well. Any of those systems can come into our main server. So keep that in mind also, sir. Over.
I certainly will. I do have some limitations of what I can do at the station. Unfortunately, I don't have complete carte blanche. There's some things I have to pass through with the trustee and so on, of course, our IT department. But if there is something that I can use to augment a system at W1AW to further the capabilities and so on, even if the justification is for MCOM use, I try to incorporate it if I could. So thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll talk about this as time goes along, Joe. We have available time and space, and you know, I'd love to have W1AW in the family. We could probably cross-modulate, is that the word that I want to use? Some of your programming that you would like to air on a different channel simultaneously to yours. And that can be done too, very easily, I might add. All right, back to you, Susie. Thank you, KY6V. Over.
Well, thank you, Gordon. And all very interesting stuff. And thanks, Joe, again for handling that for us. And I am going to call on another one of our members, George, KW4LCB, who happens to be a tower guy. And he wants to go back and ask a question about some towers or antennas. So, George, KW4LCB, Lima Charlie Bravo, come on aboard with your question for Joe.
Well, good evening, Joe. KW4, Lima Charlie Bravo, George, back with you. Let me start out by thank you for doing the get-together with us tonight. As Kathy did mention, yeah, I do climb. Been climbing all my life. Learned to climb up Mama's knee there. I guess that what got me going, and been climbing ever since. But the question I had for you there, and I'm well, what can I say? I always look at things to the basics, you know. I've got enough aluminum around here to probably build whatever type beam antenna that I want to, but I'm playing with wires because I feel it's basics, And I do always believe in being prepared. As a conch born and raised in the Keys, I grew up with hurricanes. So, you know, like I said, we always had to prepare. But what I wanted to ask you was that, let me grab a nickel here. Yes, I'm coming through the repeater here, so I need to let everything catch up there. But what would be, you know, your ditty bag, so to speak, in preparedness for a disaster? You know, I think my personal opinion is, as long as I can grab me a roll of wire, you know, I can talk there, or who knows, maybe a gutter or an old fence or something like that. But you know, I hear people talking about all these antennas there, and true to they might hold up in 135-mile-an-hour wind, but that doesn't say that tree limb it's flying in that 135-mile-an-hour wind ain't going to take it down there. But what would you have in an old trunk somewhere that can always keep you on the air? KW4, Charlie Bravo, and again, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, George. Nice to meet you, and thank you for having me this evening. Well, I came from a time when I literally had to build antennas out of scrap. When my father worked, he would get scrap wire, and I would put these scrap antennas together, and I would get on the air. And that's kind of carried over now, although I wouldn't say I use scrap. I actually will buy wire to it. But, excuse me, for emergencies, because I have to guarantee, or at least try to guarantee, that we're on the air for as long as we could, I do have a simple dipoles that I can throw up in a moment's notice. For example, if just something happened and both my 40s failed, I have a 40-meter dipole that I can string up rather quickly. On every one of the towers, I have pulleys located at the top with Dacron lines, which run all the way down. So I can hoist pulleys, I can hoist dipoles up, wire antennas, very quickly if need be. In each one of the tower boxes, I also have at least one, in some cases two, spare lines that I actually can run this dipole antenna to if I don't want to take the line off the existing antenna. So I actually have a couple of backups that I keep just in case. I never want to have to use them, but I do have them on the offside chance we need to use them. Because you're right, these antennas, as I mentioned earlier, are survivors. They're rated for 125 miles an hour, but I sincerely doubt that it would last that long if that was a sustained wind. And even if it somehow they did, if something else failed next to it, well, this object that failed is now going to be traveling at 125 miles an hour, and it's going to take out that antenna. So while I try to remain confident that they would last at least a little while, I don't put all the faith into them, and I do have a backup antennas for a couple of advantages if we need to. So I do have them for 80 and 40, and for if I needed something for 20, I actually have a dipole for 20. I've removed the insulators from it, but I could throw up very quickly if need to as well. And that was one of the reasons why I put these Dacron lines on all the towers, is if I need to pull up something very quickly. And they do serve a dual purpose, too. If I want to test an antenna or just play with something for a little while, I even use it for when we're doing sweepstakes, so I put a low 40 on, I have them there as well. So I do have, for at least for antennas, I do have a couple of backups in place. Back to you.
Well, I thank you for your answers there, Joe. You know, and like I said, I believe, you know, getting back to the basics, you know, as far as the wire. Always have some wire laying around that you could put it in use. I know Gordon, when he was in South Florida and went through that hurricane there, there was a whole lot of stuff went down, and well, this, like you said, it's all kind of debris laying around that you can hunt and put stuff together with, but always try to be prepared. And a lot of the people up north this past week has learned to deal with some of the problems that we've experienced over the years here in the south with hurricanes, and just trying to put a bug in their ear so, you know, they might have a little bit of insight to as things might happen. So it's always good to have a few wire antennas tucked away so they can string up, because no telling who and when you might be called to help out. Appreciate it. And KW4, Rima Charlie Bravo. You have a great evening.
Well, thank you very much, George, for the comments. And it is really a good idea to actually have something to back your station up with as far as antennas go. I never thought of it before, but maybe that's something we can all put in our go bag, some antennas, so that we can get our radios back on the air in emergencies. Which brings me to something else I thought we might cover tonight. Speaking of hurricanes, and recently we all suffered in the north, Hurricane Irene. In 1938, there was a hurricane, and W1AW went off the air because they lost electricity, and there was no backup system in place. Which eventually, they had two Cato generators to supply enough power to run W1AW. Now, I imagine things have changed since 1938 and that particular hurricane. Joe, could you tell us what you did during Hurricane Irene, how you prepared for it, and how the station is prepared to stay on the air?
Well, again, thank you very much, George. A pleasure meeting you, and thank you very much for your question there. And yes, in my little bag, I have, just a quick comment, I have enough wire to make a 40-meter dipole fed with 300 ohms, a little bit of stuff. Anyway, for backup brief for Irene, we do have the 60 kilowatt diesel, and I would like to make a comment. A little, it's actually a fun little story about the backup power we had prior to the renovation. For those who've ever visited the station, we used to bring them down to the cellar because we had another transmitter down there. We had a QSL card collection, and in the corner we had a 10 kilowatt propane generator, which provided power to the transmitters, and that was in part because of losing power, the hurricane and so on. Well, when we were renovating the station, the building inspector, I mean the fire marshal, had come through to check it out, and because we were really gutting the building, and they saw the generator down there, and they almost read us the riot act, telling us pretty much how illegal that was to be done. Now, granted, it was vented outside. The exhaust did go outside, but it wasn't enough because it was a propane-driven generator and it was inside a building. That was clearly illegal, and we're lucky that we were taking it out. So just a little note there, never put the generator inside, regardless of whether or not you're venting it on the outside. But anyway, for Irene, we had the station set up. It was manned from 7 a.m. Saturday up until 2 p.m. Sunday afternoon, around the clock, by ARRL staff, specifically Mike Corey, 35 NPC, who is our emergency coordinating manager, was there. Sean Cutco, KXNX, who's actually our contest manager, was there, kind of checking in. I was there various times. At one point, we had a few of the staffers show up. Steve Ewald, WB1X, who is our field organization guy. And even Jody Morin, KA1JPA, who works in our graphics illustration. She's an active ham. She was there, too, lending a hand. So we actually had coverage throughout that entire event. And what we were doing is we were more of a support. We were not jumping into it great guns. We never do that. We were always in the background pretty much saying, if you need us, we are here. So we were monitoring the nets on 40 and 20 meters. If a net opened up on 75, we were listening to that as well. We were sending updates to Taunton through EchoLink on a regular basis. whether they were reports of what was occurring in Newington, or whether we were getting them over 2 meters, or even on HF, we were sending them up to Taunton, the National Weather Service there. And that was pretty much it. We were in a monitoring capacity, and as the storm got closer, the reports obviously kind of banked up a little quick. And let me just drop this for a second. As the storm got closer to us, the reports were coming in more and more. We were sending more data up to Taunton for their information and so on. But in addition to the HF, I checked the generator to make sure we can kick onto it at a moment's notice, which we can. We do have the ability to just kick over the generator power at any time if we needed to. In addition to the HF, we were monitoring the Connecticut Aries Net, which was on one of the local repeaters. Again, we had the EchoLink. We were connected to WX Talk, and we were sending them updates on a regular basis. I had my WinLink HF section going, just in case we lost internet, because our internet connection comes directly from headquarters. We were also monitoring the DSTAR system, W1HQ Module A, which is 23 centimeters, in case anyone needed to us. Our EchoLink conference server, WNWBBCT, I had turned over temporarily to the field organization in the event they needed it. Normally, it's used just for our broadcast. Users are muted, and it's one way. In this case, I unmuted everyone, and we let them know this is here for your use. So anyone down the Eastern Seaboard who might have needed a conference server for whatever reason, that was available to them as well. It's since been moved back for regular duty. And, of course, we're also monitoring our RLP node, again, just in case someone else wanted to connect to us for whatever the reason. So, again, there's a monitoring capacity. And we kind of did the same thing during Hurricane Katrina, although there was a point during Katrina that we were actually passing traffic simply because operators were getting fatigued and they didn't have very good propagation, and we were... And I don't say this with to be glib or anything like that, but we were the only station on the air at the time that people could hear. So at that time, we were actually passing traffic. But it was more for support this time around. Back to you, Susan.
Well, thanks very much, Joe, for answering that and covering it, because Hurricane Irene was something that we were all concerned with. And it's nice to see what part W1AW had in it. Let me open up the floor and see if anybody has any comments or questions about anything that we've covered here, and then we'll be moving along. And we're almost at the end of our program. It's 28 minutes past the second hour, and tonight's special guest is Joe Garcia, station manager for W1AW, and this is N1SUZ. So let me open up to the floor and see if anyone has any other comments about our hurricane or anything else that we've talked about already.
Six Victor with a question for Joe.
Go right ahead, Gordon.
Just a quickie. Joe, do you have cross-patching capabilities? Take any of your HF audio into EchoLink or IRLP, sir, over?
Yes and no. We do have the audio, which normally for our regular conference server, BBCT, I have quick access to that, so I can immediately, or very matter of fact, I should say, take audio from any one of the transceivers, the HF transceivers, or even the HF, for that matter, and dump that right into there. For IRLP, I don't, and only because I haven't seen any real need for it. We have had some instances where hurricanes had occurred, like near the West Gulf, near Texas, and so on. They were using EchoLink to actually monitor, say, the local HF nets and dumping it up to EchoLink. And that's why I put a little more effort into the EchoLink there to be able to dump audio into that. So, like I said, it's kind of yes and no. Not so much for IRLP, but certainly for EchoLink.
That's good. Do you run Vox when you do that? We have that capability here on the SCARS also. I can cross-link, as an example, HF to EchoLink. In a Vox status, so you don't have to have an operator sitting there, you know, throwing the button. Is that the way you're set up, sir? Over.
Right now, for the conference server, the system is keyed when it gets a king signal from the computers. So as soon as we either do CW or the digital, it actually gets a king signal from there. But yes, if I was going to use EchoLink in an MCOM situation where I was taking audio, say, from a local HFNet and dumping it into there, I would use the box. The nice thing where my EchoLink setup is located is it's right next to my TS-480, which is what I also use for Mars. So pretty much I could just hook the cable right up and change the settings a little bit within EchoLink to tell it, okay, use Vox if you need to, and it can go from there. As part of the king system for the regular broadcast, I actually had to build a simple interface to get the king signals, and that's what I would kind of use as well.
Fantastic. I think, Joe, you and I need to have some more conversation as time permits. We've got a terrific capability between the two of us. You know, SouthCars has stated this very openly for a long, long time, that our server is open for anybody that is under emergency conditions. If an Aries group or any of the other emergency facilities need our services, we'll turn the server directly over to them and let them run the show. So we got a lot to talk about. Back to you, Susie. I'd like to collar this guy just about the time you're ready to wrap this thing up, because I'm going to push another thing at him. Susie, KY6V, over.
Oh, very good, Gordon. Yes, and I will give you that opportunity so you can do that. Know all about that. But thanks, Gordon, and thanks again, Joe. So there's a lot of capabilities that W1AW has, and in the 21st century, we talked about RLPs, EchoLink, WL2K, Mars, etc. But something that I don't think everybody knows out there is about Oscar 1, the first amateur radio satellite. And this year was the 50th anniversary of Oscar 1. And I believe the Smithsonian has one. And I believe that ARRL had one. And I also believe that Joe had a hand in getting the Oscar 1 back in operating condition and having it be able to transmit again. So before we wrap up, I'd just like Joe to tell us a little bit about Oscar 1 and getting it back into working shape. Just goes to show you how talented this guy is. So Joe, can you come aboard and tell us about Oscar 1?
Oh, that is a sordid tale, to be sure. I kid. It's as everyone knows, it was the 50th anniversary of the launch of Oscar 1, the first non-government, you know, launched on a government bird, the non-government amateur satellite built by hams for pretty much anyone to listen to. And there were three units that were built. Obviously, the first one that went up and was in orbit for 22 days. And there were two more. They were kind of the backups. Yes, the Smithsonian got the better-looking one, and we had gotten one too. And the Oscar one that we had on display just fell into disarray. I mean, it hung from the ceiling in the lobby for years. When the lobby was changed, it was just kind of put away in storage, and no one really knew what to do with it, because it's like, well, what do we do with this thing? And then earlier this year, the lab, Bob Allison, the product engineer, thank gosh, it's the 50th anniversary, and wouldn't it be kind of cool to get Oscar 1 working again? Well, it looked as though somebody had tried to work on it years ago and did an absolute horrible job. One of the problems is that I could not find, or I guess this person could not find, the real schematic for it. And if you look at CQ, if you look at 73, some of the schematics for, they didn't jive. One would use NPNs, the other would use TNPs, and of course, the components were not missing in the one that we had. So after a lot of research and actually talking to Lance Jenner, Cases GSJ, the guy who was involved with building this satellite, I managed to get the schematic, and it took a while to rebuild this thing because the components, for example, the trimmer caps were made out of glass, and two of them were broken. And as long as you didn't touch them, they would kind of work. I was able to get the transmitter going. I was actually able to find a manufacturer, it was on ICM or even Jan Crystals, but the Bomar was even able to grind for me the actual crystal to put us on 145 megahertz, and I didn't have to order 50 of them. They were able to do one for me. Obviously, we had to substitute some components because the components that were in there, I couldn't find them. They were not available. They were discontinued. And, of course, was the issue with which schematic should I use. But I managed to get the transmitter going. The one downside of it is that because the caps were broken, and you really couldn't glue them because the glue would have actually seeped through and locked up the trimmer, it was a little sensitive. So if you wrapped it really hard, it would be off frequency. But we got it to transmit, and it had this really weird do-it-do-it-do-it sound to it. And at Dayton this year, At Dayton this year, some of the hams that were around when Oscar 1 was launched, who actually listened to it, commented to us that that's exactly how it sounded when they listened to it over the air. So I felt kind of good about that. Now, it consisted of a transmitter, a couple of batteries, a King matrix, as well as a clock. And essentially the way it worked was there were two thermistors in there. The thermistors were set into their version of like a JK flip-flop or multi-vibrator, and that would determine the speed of this thing. Now the downside is that I guess the original one never really worked because it sounded like it was sending at 80 words a minute. But depending upon the temperature, the speed would vary. So they were able to extrapolate what the inside temperature of this bird was based upon the code speed. Well, the only literature I could find on the clock and the keyer was not what I had on the board. I actually stood there and painstakingly traced this thing out component by component, saying, okay, here's a transistor, here's another transistor, this is connected to resistors, this is connected to diodes. And after all that work, I found that the one schematic we had didn't match. And what I had drawn out didn't look like anything. And we figured it because it was probably because it was just a mock-up. So we were kind of stuck there. I didn't have the proper schematic. The people who were still around that worked on the original one did not have the literature with them, and they actually apologized for not saving it. So I didn't have the schematic at all. Rather than just rebuild it, we decided, okay, why don't we just get the transmitter going, and we will key it with a little pick keyer, which is actually a beacon keyer, hidden inside one of the little boxes where the battery actually was located. Let me drop this for a second. So we kind of had a mixture of the original technology from 1961, married up to 2011 technology. And that was fine. Hams understood that it was a miracle we got the thing working anyway, considering that literature was scarce. I didn't have any information at all on two of the three boards, and the fact that the components were actually broken. And we managed to get the thing going. Obviously, we weren't using batteries. We were providing 9-volt DC off of wall wart to feed it, and that was fine. It was in its own little case. We wrote up some material about it, the brief history of it, who was actually involved. And we had done that to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the launch. And I was lucky in that Lance Jenner was able to provide me with a couple of photographs that were taken at the time of him working on it, of him and someone else working on actually on Oscar 2 and 3. And we were to incorporate that into the presentation. But it was pretty interesting. We didn't have to get licensing for it because it pretty much had a coverage of about 100 feet. So once you got out of 100 feet from the main aerial area at Dayton, you didn't hear it at all, and that was fine. But it was quite a challenge considering everything we had to work with or not work with. Our satellite books did have schematics, but again, there were just enough variations And in fact, even in the 73 article, or the CQ article, it even said in there that the technical information is not being supplied because the authors may want to write a paper on this. So right away, I did not have all the pieces, parts to really get this verb going. Back to you, Suzanne.
Well, thank you so much, Joe, for describing that. It really fascinated me when I was hearing and reading about that. And I'm really impressed of what you were able to do with it. And satellites really intrigue me, so that's something my next step in some research and getting into satellite communications. But I want to thank you very much, and I'm going to open it up to the floor to see if anybody has any questions about the satellites. So anybody would like to comment or have a question about satellites? All right, nothing heard. I'm going to, before I ask for any general questions about anything we haven't covered and wanted to ask you, I want to see, Joe, if there's anything else that you'd like to cover tonight. It seems as though we're getting towards the end of what we wanted to talk about tonight. And I'll open it up to you to see if there's anything else that you'd like to discuss or have any of us know about. So, Joe, if you come aboard and let me know.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, just what I'd like to say that I'm glad when visitors come in to W1EW and find they have a real nice experience in there. And Gordon and I were kind of having this conversation yesterday. I think I briefly mentioned it before at the start of this program, but I will have visitors come in from all over the world, all classes of license, all types of experience. And I am by far from any sort of expert. I always tell the guys in the lab, I'm a hack, because that's how I grew up. I had to grow up being a hack, having to do the stuff on my own, having to scavenger stuff and so on. So I kind of take that into the station as well. But the fact that I do meet so many different people that come in there, and they have all sorts of conceptions, and some of them misconceptions about amateur radio and even Aero headquarters itself, that it's very interesting to see the varying opinions as to what's going on within the service itself. And again, as I mentioned to Gordon yesterday, that we call it a hobby, and we say it's a hobby, and it's acknowledged as a hobby, but I like to use the term service. The FCC refers to it as a service, as a licensed service, and we truly are a service. I firmly believe, and I've been in this hobby since 79, actually before that, that it's not just a hobby. This is a service. We provide a service, and I don't just mean the league. I mean just hands in general. We provide a service, whether it be through MCOM, whether it be just through camaraderie within amateur radio. We are providing service to each other, our fellow hands, and even to the general community. That I want that to be reflected at W1AW. We want W1AW to be the flagship station. I want it to be the flagship station. We call it the flagship station, I believe. To try to have the latest technical equipment there, but it's not always possible. We, like everyone else, we have budgetary concerns, and there are certain areas where my hands are absolutely tied, and that's fine. We learn to deal with that. But just the fact that people can come in and they see the station and they leave happy is very important. And we talked briefly about the 21st century and capabilities, and I do get hams that they'll look at, for example, what we're doing tonight, Echolink, and they'll say that is not ham radio because it's unless it's strictly RF, it's not ham radio. And I would beg to differ with them. I, like everything else, it is another facet of this service. It provides another outlet for licensed hams to use if they cannot use RF. I believe George mentioned he's coming in through a 2-meter system. Well, that's, let me drop it here for a second. That's very cool because, okay, there is the RF section of this system that we're using here. The IRLP, okay, there's internet in between, but there's RF involved. So, but it's another side of amateur, it's another facet. It's not going to take it over. It's not going to diminish HF or all the experimentation and fun that goes into it. But I guess I'm trying to say that amateur radio has been so rewarding to me that even my little part, even just doing what I can at the station, I try to give back into that. And it's always been a lot of fun. And in this case, I'm honored again that you guys have asked me to speak about the station, about the ham station, really. It's at the league, we're a membership organization, but it's for the hams to use in general. And I'm very proud of it, and I'm proud that you asked me to do this as well. Back to you, Stan.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. And I have to say that my experience at W1AW was very positive. It was like a wonderful day. It was a wonderful experience, and everyone there was so nice. And from the top guy there down to whoever there, everyone was very gracious and answered all my questions. I had a zillion questions. You know that because I asked you a zillion questions too. But we had a positive experience, and it was because of people who have the enthusiasm and passion for the hobby like you do. And I want to thank you very much for being here. But before I let you go, I'm going to open the floor up for questions on anything. And I think we may have a few people there out there who would like to ask you something that we may not have covered tonight. We've gone through history, the artifacts, going into the 21st century, a whole bunch of stuff, because W1AW is a lot of things. But let me open up to the floor for any general questions, anything that we haven't covered tonight, something that you might want to ask Joe, NJ1Q. This is N1SUZ, and last call for any comments or questions for Joe. Come on aboard now.
Well, I'll jump into that pause. Six Victor.
Very good. Gordon, come on aboard, Six Victor.
Thank you, m'lady. Joe, it's been an absolute pleasure, sir, not only having you with us tonight, but meeting you for the first time here yesterday. Joe, I'm going to ask you a question. You don't have to answer this tonight. You may have to think about it. First question, how was the first day in school for the young one? Second, I want to tell you that on the 8th of September, knowing your busy schedule, you may not be able to do anything with us, but I'm going to ask anyway. Let me look at my calendar and make sure I'm quoting this correctly. Yes, Thursday the 8th of September, Suzanne, who's our section manager for the Thursday night TNT that we're on here this evening, got a hold of me several weeks ago and said, would you consider putting on a TNT on antennas? Both UHF, VHF, and HF, and everything that is involved. And I gave that some thought, and I said, sure, I'd be happy to. Joe, we've got four or five other rather talented guys that are going to join us, we hope. I don't have confirmation for everybody yet. That have walked the walk, have worn the moccasins. And I'd sure love to have you in that group. Would you consider maybe the 8th coming aboard and showing and giving some of your talent in the areas? And we're going to be talking about, you know, popular antennas for each of the different frequencies. We're going to be talking about feed lines. We're going to be talking about how to properly measure your SWR and establishing a proper resonance of the antenna and that kind of stuff. What do you think, Joe? KY6V, over.
Oh, fine business. One quick note to you, Suzanne. I'm very glad that when you came to headquarters in 1AW that you had a really good time and your answers were questions. Answers were questions? Okay. Your questions were answered. One of the things that we've always impressed, or at least I used to impress upon my tour guide trainees, is that the staff there, we're a membership organization, we're there for the membership, but we're also there if someone has a question, because quite frankly, if they have a question, they need some help, and we may have an answer. If we don't have an answer, we let them know, but if we do, we try to help. Never would we look at anyone, whether they come out the street, telephone, email, look at it as a bother. That's all part of why we're there. So again, I'm just glad that everyone was able to help and that they were friendly as well. They should be friendly. They should be friendly. Gordon, his first day of school was very good. He started seventh grade today. My little son, yes, I'm trying to get him to be him. He does want to be an engineer, so that's a good thing. He actually came home excited. He's got some of the friends from last year in his classes. He seems to like his teacher. His science teacher, he actually had his wife, who's also a science teacher, in middle school or grade school. So he actually had a very good day. And as I told Suzanne earlier, we only have 182 days to go. Let's just keep that momentum. And unfortunately, as much as I would love to go with the TNT and actually honor the GF, even though I am a hack, I am far from any expert. I opened the book more than anything else. I'm actually working the night shift that entire week. My night operator is going on vacation. And being managed doesn't always have perks. Someone has to cover for him. So I'm actually going to be working all that week, and even the week after that, I'm going to be working because he's going to be on vacation. So unfortunately, I will not be able to attend that. But I do appreciate the offer. Thank you very much. Back to you, Gordon.
Oh, that's too bad. Okay. Well, we'll just, maybe we can work it out sometime in the future, Joe. Again, thank you very, very much, sir, for your contribution tonight. I will tell you that this entire session this evening that you and Suzanne have orchestrated has been recorded. It will be on as an audio podcast on our website sometime in the near future. So you can sit back and reminisce. Suzanne, back to you, and thank you from KY6V. Over.
Well, thank you very much, Gordon, and thank you again, Joe, and too bad you won't be able to make it, because that should be a great session. Gordon is the man with antennas. And I'm going to call on Kathy. I don't know if she's still out there, but I know she had a question for you, Joe. This might be too late for her, because she's a teacher, and she probably has to get going. Kathy, K6SUN, are you still around, Kathy? If you are, come on aboard.
I think she's retired, Susie, but I'll tell you what, she did mention to me via text that she wanted to ask about the Contiki. Can I ask Joe about that?
You go right ahead, Gordon, and I'll have to apologize to Kathy that this ran a little too late for her, because I know she wanted to ask Joe about that. So, yes, Gordon, if you could cover that question for her, that would be great.
All right. Thanks, Suze. Joe, we had a program here on TNT a week or two back that covered the voyage of the raft Contiki. If you are knowledgeable at all on that expedition, it was a movement from South America, Peru specifically, over to the Polynesian Islands, trying to substantiate that the earlier days before Columbus, that people could still travel far distances across the water. At any rate, the bottom line of this is that expedition was fostered with communication on board this raft via amateur radio. It happened in 1947. A little earlier than you got into ham radio, but you probably have maybe picked up some of the stuff through ARRL. W1AW was apparently involved in this. A number of key stations throughout the United States were set up as relays from this raft that traveled over 4,000 miles. Do you know anything about that, Joe? Any comments on it that we could add to our program here of a couple of weeks ago? Over.
Oh, gosh. You got me on that one. I mean, I do know about the Contiki and so on, and that the radio was involved. I'm trying to think back, but now the part about 1AW, I'm not specifically sure, although I would no doubt, because, again, not to brag, we would have been one of the larger stations back then that would probably have had the capabilities. I do remember that we ran an article in QST, I believe a few years ago, about the expedition. And the reason we did that is because someone else, if I recall the article correctly, tried to reproduce the mission. They had built a similar type craft, pretty much the specifications of the original Contiki, and tried to do the journey again. And obviously one of the reasons it was important to us is because they also used amateur radio. So I think we actually ran an article about that in QST. Over.
Yeah, I don't know about the replay, but QST also covered the 1947 episode. And it detailed the stations that were involved. It was very well done. The Norwegian, these guys were, or particularly Norwegians that were sailing this craft across the Pacific. And the Norwegian embassy here in the United States was in communication with a number of key hams. We had one of the major stations was a university up in Pennsylvania. We had a couple out in California, and so on went the story. And QST detailed it in very nice fashion. All right. Well, thank you very much. I'll tell Kathy whenever I talk with her next that I asked the question. Susie, back to you from KY6V. Over.
RFK Mobile.
All right, RFK Mobile. I believe you must have a comment or a question. Come on in.
I didn't realize it was a net. It sounded like everybody was just chewing the rag. W4RFJ Mobile, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah. We're having a program tonight. This is TNT, and we are talking with special guest Joe Carcia, NJ1Q, the station manager for W1AW, the ARRR's very own flagship station. So I'm going to turn over to you briefly for a moment, Joe, if you want to make any last comments before we wrap up this great evening. We really appreciate you being here, and let me hand it back to you and for any last comments before we wrap it up for tonight.
All right, Suzanne. Well, again, thank you very much for having me on the program this evening. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed myself, and it was a pleasure talking with everybody out there. And again, I'm honored that you asked. And I often say it, and I say a lot to visitors who are just passing through. If you ever get the opportunity to come by the station, please feel free. We usually start with a tour at headquarters first, and we usually end at the station. And I tell people the station's the only real important part of the tour anyway. Visitor off times are 10 to 12 and 1 to 3:45 daily. And get you on the air, and you can have a lot of fun. So we'll like to say 73, and again, thank you very much. And back to me. And once again, NJ1Q.
Well, thank you, Joe. Thank you for your enthusiasm and your passion for the amateur radio and for sharing W1AW with us. We all appreciate on South Cars that you stopped by, taking time out of your very busy schedule at work, and then taking time away from your family to come talk to us, too. But we really appreciate it. And it's programming like this that really spreads the word and helps ham operators achieve a different level to learn all sorts of things out there. But definitely, we really appreciate you coming out here, and thank you for the time that you spent with me at the station talking to me. And yeah, I kind of feel that the important part of the tour was W1AW too. And I am going back there too. I don't live that far away. I don't know why I haven't visited it before. So I want to thank you very much. And from South Cars to you, 73s, and I'm going to wind the net down now. First, before we end tonight's presentation, well, actually we did end it, but I want to make some announcements before everybody goes home. First of all, announcements for this week. NCS and administrative people are needed. please contact us at voip@southcars.com. Worldwide hospitality people are required to act as South Cars ambassadors of goodwill. For further information, please contact us at voip@southcars.com. The 2011 South Cars Outreach Program. Technician license classes were completed on June 5th, and general upgrade classes were completed earlier this year. Thank you very much. That's when I got my general license. Recordings of all sessions may be found at www.voip.southcars.com. Navigate from the SCARS download link, and you will find them. Extra class upgrade classes began on August 7, 2011, and will conclude on September 13, 2011. Classes are being held on Sunday and Tuesday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Although the course is over halfway, it isn't too late to enroll. Contact voip@southcars.com to enroll, and catch-up recordings are on our website. And in the future, an International Morse Code class is scheduled to be presented during the first quarter of 2012. See www.voip.southcars.com for further information on all these topics. Now, this has been South Cars. This has been a special TNT program, the South Cars Coast Amateur Radio Service. VOIP net schedules or general information may be found on the voip.southcars.com website. Your net control for this session has been Suzanne, that's me, N1SUZ, and I'm saying 73 to everybody out there and closing this VOIP session. Thank you to everybody for participating. Thank you, Joe, for being here, and everyone have a great evening. The net is officially closed and going back to regular service. Thanks, everybody.
NJ1Q, KW4, AMR Charlie, Bravo, and I'd like to thank you also, Joe, taking your time to be with us tonight. So, yeah, you ever make it to Orlando at the Ham Fest? Well, maybe we can get together and do a eyeball. KW4, Lima, Charlie, Bravo, you have a blessed night.
Well, thank you, George. Well, my lovely bride does want to go to Disneyland again one day. She loves it down there. So I may take up with an offer. So thank you very much, and you are most welcome, and you have a good night as well. KW4LCD, this is Susan 2NQ. 7 Future.